Well, I got an error playing the recording. I'm sorry, folks. I don't know why that has happened. So maybe we won't have music. Hang on a minute. John's going to be angry with me that I didn't get the music going here. Okay, everybody. Hello. It is January 2nd. 2017. We're starting the year with no music. I hope that's not an omen, but the music recorder's not working, so you get no song today. So maybe we'll have some of the guys sing for people before we're done here. Anyway, John's not here tonight. This is Gerard running the show, and we got a lot of different things going on, and I just want to bring up some of the latest stuff everybody knows we're filing papers and we got a number and they accepted our case today, which is a good thing, and so we're kind of excited by that, but we're not really sure, what the next step's going to be with them because, strategy here as far as we want to keep this thing in the Northern District, and that's what we're working on anyway, but that's not important. What is important is this whole business of what we're doing and why we're doing and the whole grand jury situation. And, we started on this thing, using U.S. versus Williams was the thing that really animated us, I guess you could say, after going through and getting into the courts, and that's what really brought us on point. And today I was able to revisit that, and it brought up some stuff that you know when you're doing something all the time and you get used to it, you tend to forget things. Hang on a minute, I want to pull up my U.S. versus Williams. And the principle under that case is so powerful, we tend to forget, what was said and why. Because I was with somebody yesterday that does, a lot of legal work in the system, very good guy, but very statutory in as far as his outlook on things. And, he didn't understand how we could bring in common law into the courts, because there is that case. Not that case. There's that ruling that the judge quoted on us early on, and they quote all the time, that when the Constitution came in, that anything in the common law that was inimical to the Constitution was null and void, that didn't fit, because a lot of the common law stuff carried forward, because obviously there were contracts and things that we couldn't just throw out. This country was founded for 150 years almost before that happened, so that stuff had to go through. So they made a caveat that said that those things would go forward and only the things that were inimical to the Constitution. So that gets very, people say, oh, well, the common law has been abrogated. Well, no, it hasn't, because the Constitution, the Bill of Rights are common law documents. And our country was founded under the principles of the Magna Carta. If you could abrogate common law, that would mean that we don't have a Constitution or a Declaration of Independence. As a matter of fact, you'd have to go back and abrogate the Magna Carta. So how could that idea even, come to fruition, hang on a minute here. I don't seem to be able to bring my U.S. versus Williams up here. I want to read off of the top of that. Let me see if I can find that. You have to bear with me here. Yeah. I just had it, and it went down. Hang on. Here we go. I'm sorry. So, you know, this government loves, you know, all these magic things to keep us in check. But, you know, we have to use common sense, and common law is common sense, and it is our heritage. And they don't, you know, nobody learns the Constitution, nobody learns the fundamental principles, and that's why we're in the situation we're in. Now, if you look, you know, we're going into court with this case, and we have to let the judge know, you know, they want to call us petitioner and all this other stuff. They give us a whole paper that tells us what we should do and who we are and how we should act. And now our next job is to go in and tell them who we are and how we're going to act and who they are, you see, because we're the people. We're not a petitioner. Matter of fact, we're going to get our money back because what we're doing is going for justice, which they should not be charged for. So anybody that doesn't understand, they say, oh, how are you going to get the common law back? The grand jury in with the sheriff, they got laws that tell you how to do that in the state, and you can't. And if it's in the Constitution of the state that tells you how to do it, then you have to change the Constitution. Well, that's not the case. It's not in the state Constitution. And right here in U.S. versus Williams, it sums up the whole thing. And Scalia wouldn't have wrote this if it wasn't true. I mean, he is one of the premier fundamental guys out there, God rest his soul. And in this summary of U.S. versus Williams, it says, we the people have been provincially provided legal recourse to address the criminal conduct of persons themselves entrusted to dispense justice. In the Supreme Court of the United States v. William, 112, cite, Justice Anton Scalia, writing for the majority, confirmed that the American grand jury is neither part of the judicial, executive, nor legislative branches of government, but instead belongs to the people. It is, in effect, a fourth branch of government, governed, quote-unquote, and administered to directly by and on behalf of the American people, and its authority emanates from the Bill of Rights. Any questions, Your Honor? You see, we're going to write a paper with that on the heading, because that really sets us up to where we need to be with our relationship with them, and that's who we are. We are the people, and we're coming in as a tribunal, and they have to accept that, and he has to accept the fact that he's a magistrate. This is going to be very interesting, people, so, you know, stay tuned. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on here, and this is the time and the season. So I don't want to – that's basically what I wanted to talk about. That's what I have, you know, on what we're doing, and that's where we're at. We're back to those fundamental principles, and we have to assert ourselves now. So, you know, we have a lot of things going on with committees of safety and all that, but it all flies under this banner. What I would like to see, you know, we need civic action. There's no doubt about it. You know, we see that when we do our courtroom watches, when people come out, the judges get all nervous. You get five people in court with pencil and pen, and all of a sudden everything changes because there's actual people that can't be controlled documenting things, doing affidavits, and they know they can't change the transcript. And pretty soon you see all of a sudden the gears shift and they act differently because they don't operate the same way in the light as they do in the dark. So that's a small part of civic actions, even the courtroom watchers. You know, Bob Schultz went to Washington with a bunch of people, filed a bunch of paper, articles of freedom, you know. But all these things that we're doing, you know, we don't see them working. Glenn Beck had a million or I don't know how many million people in Washington, D.C. It's good, but it didn't do anything. It's because all that civic action that they're doing, there was no instruction there. There was nothing going on. It's one thing, you know, Bob Schultz sued brought to the question on the First Amendment, do the people have the right to redress of grievances? And if the government doesn't answer, can we hold them accountable? And part of holding them accountable would be no taxes until they answer. So they refuse to answer that multiple times. They don't want to answer that. It's the only there's like four parts of the First Amendment, and that's or five parts, and that's the only one that hasn't been tried in court that they don't want to try because they're afraid of it, because they know what the answer is, but they don't want us to know. So how do you get them to answer that? So, you know, if you had a case in court and you had 5,000 people line up with in unison, even in a silent stand. This was Bob Schultz's idea, and he's done some of this, but for some reason it hasn't worked. And I think the reason it hasn't worked is because you got to push an issue forward with the civic action. You can't just wave signs on a corner because they don't care. But what you have to do is you have to force them to answer by having your case in front of them and having everybody out there marching with your case in their hand, saying, answer the people, answer the case, answer the paper, you know? And that's what hasn't happened. And I know there's a lot of people doing a lot of stuff out there, you know? I listened to Chris Ann Hall the other day, and she said, you know, we need to be calling the prison up there and the judges, and she's absolutely right. Everybody for this Joe, with the stock ponds that they have in prison over there. He's in Colorado, but I think the ponds were in Montana. And she's saying, look at you know, her opinion is that people are taking too big of a bite out of the apple, and I think that refers to us, that because we're doing this big case federally, that, you know, because if we win this, we win everything, where she believes that we should be doing more local stuff. Well, she's right in a way, and she's wrong in a way. You see, the big case that we're doing, if we could get everybody to come in, if we can get the Schultz people, and we could get Chris Ann Hall behind us and say, look, this is the case that's going to end all this baloney, because the government needs to answer this. Why, you know, it's great if we go to this court and that court and this court, civic action. The last time that it worked was for women's suffrage. You know, I don't know how many million women went to the streets and probably their husband's suppers didn't get cooked, but guess what? They won, right? That's the last, that's the last big one in the civil rights movement, you know, Martin Luther King and all that. We know, though, that those things worked because they were massive. So, you know, that's the only way you're going to get anything done. But my vision is, look, at you read the cases that we write and we put in. I think everybody needs to get behind this. And they need to, when it goes to court, they need to show up, and they need to send it out. They need to talk about it. It needs to be on the talk shows. We got to coalesce into a force of one where our voices are in unison. Look, you read the case we put in. It has everything in it. It has all the rancher stuff, all the prison stuff, all the abuses that they've been doing that they have no right or jurisdiction to do. Our forefathers, we the people, did not set up a government to run us like this, to make rules and regulations on how we live our lives like that. Absolutely not. Matter of fact, the rules and regulations they're making are really for them, not for us, not for a free people. I don't need to be told how to live and act morally. And you know, and if I do, that's what the court system's for. You got to beef with me. You go through that system. But certainly the government's not going to be telling me how to act and what to do. If there's no injured party, guess what? I'm doing fine. Nobody's complaining. I'm not hurting anybody. Then you know what? Leave me alone. That's what America's about. This country was designed so that you didn't have to pay any tax if you didn't want to. All you had to do is stay away from the taxable activity. And then you wouldn't get taxed, right? So what kind of taxable activity are you doing living in your home? They're going to charge you land tax, and if you don't pay it, they're going to take your property. Well, all of our rights had to be based in something. And you know what they based them on? They based them on property rights. That's the one fundamental right that our forefathers based all our rights. Look at your first piece of property is what? Your body. We don't even own them anymore. They have violated us so much that we don't even own the first piece of property that God gave us, which is our body. They're going to tell us what to put in them and where to put them and how to educate them and where to go and what to do and all this stuff. So we've lost our land already because just not pay your tax and see what happens. So you don't own it. You're paying rent to them. This is completely against everything that's American. And they're, oh, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to run the government? It's a bunch of lies. The government has plenty of money to run in plenty of different areas. We don't need to be taxing people's lands away and taxing their lives. Look, they've gotten so big. You know, your income tax, your personal income tax, doesn't go for one iota of government service. It goes to service the debt to the bankers. You're paying those trillions of dollars to bankers. Just think of what we could be doing in this country if we could keep our income tax that they're stealing from us. You see, we've been brainwashed. They only put income tax in way back after, I think it was the First World War. They said, oh, we got to pay the war debt, and as soon as it's gone, we'll take it away. That was a lie. It never went away. They had a little cartoon with Donald Duck. I remember seeing it. You know, oh, you know, do your duty. Be patriotic. Pay your income tax so we can pay this war debt. For probably wars that we could have avoided that only the bankers want to put the countries under their thumb with a fiat dollar. So now we're at this juncture to do something. We need to stick together because this is important. We finally got a president and a House and the Senate that maybe we could do something. So these are very exciting times, very very treacherous times. We're in a very treacherous time now between the inauguration. We don't know what's going to happen because the other side is lost big and they don't like it. We don't know what they're going to do. So we need to all be together and paying attention. And we need to all get involved. And we need to be ready. And I mean, look, this could become a fight. But, you know, I'd rather die fighting than die whimpering and cold and hungry, which is going to happen if we don't straighten this thing out. So there's a lot of things going on, and there's a lot of things we can be doing, but we need to be engaged. We need to be active. So that being said, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to ask if any of the other leaders have anything. I saw that Brent came in, so I can actually open up for Brent. But before I do that, I don't know, Jan, if you have anything, or Ollie, or Robert, or any of you guys. Go ahead and peek up.
Yes, I have three questions for you tonight. The first question is for either John or you or Brent, and it says, could you please give your thoughts on the differences between unalienable rights, constitutional rights, and civil rights?
Okay, unalienable, constitution, and civil.
Right.
Oh, I know Brent. I know Brent's chomping at the bit for this one, but I'm going to say a couple words first. You know, look, civil rights are something the government gives you, and that's something that you started hearing after the 14th Amendment. Civil rights are something that can be taken away or given, right? Constitutional rights, well, there's no such thing as constitutional rights, really, in my mind. The Constitution is a contract with the government to tell them what they can do. Your rights are unalienable, and they come from God. That's where they come from. They don't come from the Constitution. The Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights actually used to be called the Bill of Prohibitions because it told the government what they can't do. So constitutional rights. The only one who has constitutional rights is the government. They have a clip sovereignty. They have a certain sovereignty within those guidelines. There's the constitutional rights. They're for the government. And Brent, if you'd like to add anything to that, because I know you're way more knowledgeable than me on that stuff, go have at it.
Well, if I disagreed with anything you had said, I'd say so, but I don't. I thought those were dynamite comments, especially to make the point that it used to be called the Bill of Prohibition. There's so many ways about it, and their words become confusing because we use them in different ways, all of us. But fundamentally, I like to get down to basics if I can. You'd make the point that they're not constitutional rights, and I agree. And the court's pretty careful to say they're not, when in the cases on such subjects, they're not constitutional rights. They usually say they're constitutionally protected rights. And that's accurate, because the Constitution is there as a written guarantee that the government will protect those rights. So there are, the distinction that I see is overlooked and has become so blurry is the distinction between constitutional or fundamental rights and civil rights. Civil rights and fundamental rights. And fundamental rights are those rights that God delegates direct to the man, direct to the individual. We call those fundamental rights. And because God delegates them direct, they are non-delegable as a matter of law, and that's been recognized through the centuries. Fundamental rights, if God gives you a responsibility, and that's what a right is, then you don't have the authority to delegate that to somebody else. Take case in point, God gives you the duty, which is a right. That's what right means. It means responsibility. It isn't that every right is accompanied by a corresponding responsibility. It is that every right is a responsibility. That's a misstatement, to say it the other way. God gives you children. You have rights respecting those children, and you can't delegate that to somebody else. And our Supreme Court has said so on a number of occasions. For instance, and this is just an example of a fundamental responsibility, a fundamental right, if you have children, God gave them to you, and with that, he delegated to you the responsibility to see to their education. The Supreme Court of the United States, Pierce versus Society of Sisters, it's an old case, but it's still a good case. And then Mayer versus Nebraska, both of those recognize the fundamental right of parents, the fundamental duty, not of the government, to direct, I'm quoting the Supreme Court, direct the education of their children. Now, you can send your children, as an example again, to somebody else to educate them. But the responsibility is yours, and you will answer for it according to God, because God gave you the children, and with the children comes the responsibility, the right, the authority, the jurisdiction, if you will. All of those are synonyms. Those are fundamental rights. And our Constitution and the Bill, what we call the Bill of Rights, well put, Bill of Prohibitions to government, but also it is a guarantee of government protection of the free use of those, enjoyment of those fundamental rights. There are examples there in the 10 First Amendments. That's not all of our fundamental rights. Those are the ones that they wanted to put in to the fundamental statement of law called our U.S. Constitution, so we wouldn't forget it. But Amendment 9 says there are other rights, and any other rights cannot be disparaged because of the rights that are here enlisted and anything the government may do. I'm not quoting it, but you can go back and I think the word disparage is in there and look at it. So civil rights, civil is the old Latin word for city. That's the rights of the city law. As Blackstone says, the municipal law, he calls it in his first volume. And that those rights, responsibilities, are those that government conjures up themselves. Men make those up. They think they're important. They may be valid if they're consonant with God's laws of nature and laws of nature's God. Well, that's okay. But if they aren't, then they're no good. They're just talk. A guy said to me the other day, you know, it's fascinating. Men make laws, and because the laws men make are not consonant with the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, then men have to make up the, they have to hire people to enforce those laws to exact the consequences. And he said, you know, God doesn't do that. You break God's law, his laws of nature, you'll pay the price. Well, you can't even break the law. You can just break yourself on it. But there's a difference between that which is fundamental of God, which he delegates, and civil rights. Civil rights that was coined by the left, coined by the humanists, coined by the lawless, godless crowd to speak of those rights that men say you have, responsibilities. And, of course, they wanted to do that because they want man to be the measure of all things and the mind of man to be the measure of all things and not the first principles of the laws of nature and the laws of nature of God. Because if men have the power to make law, then men can control men and men can dominate men. And that's never been our point of view here in America, not fundamentally. So civil rights are the rights that men put on, the responsibilities, duties, jurisdiction that men put upon men. They may be valid, they may not be. Fundamental rights are those responsibilities God delegates directly to the individual, and those are non-delegable. And that's fundamentally the distinctions that I think are important. Gerard?
Thank you, Brent. I appreciate that. Jan, you said you had another question there, right?
Yes, I have two more for you. The next one is, could you please provide me with two Supreme Court cases from the 1980s that smashed judicial immunity for judges in America? Two Supreme Court cases.
What am I, in school here?
looks yeah. like it.
in the 1980s, I'd have to go to LexisNexis. I have no idea. I guess maybe I should know that. What do you think, Brent?
No, that's, I didn't hear exactly two cases that do what? Something about judicial immunity? I didn't catch it.
I don't know if there is cases that smash judicial immunity. That would be to the judges. They would never have a case go through that would smash.
No.
First of all, judicial immunity is not necessarily a bad thing. The reason that whole process came about was because in order for a judge to do his job, he has to have a certain immunity and not worry about repercussions of him making the right decisions. You know what I mean? So there has to be some sort of immunity. But they take it to the point now. What they've done is they make it so you can't hold their feet to any fire now. They're just out of hand. I'm immune. You know, and they declare their own immunity. You know, if anybody's going to give them immunity, it should be us. It shouldn't be them declaring it. So that's my idea with that. I guess probably you agree with that, Brent.
Oh yeah, as a general matter, I guess it'd be maybe a smart thing to define the scope of judicial immunity. Judges are subject to law like all other men unless they leave their scope of their judicial role. And that's the words the courts use. They call it the scope of the judicial role. And within that scope of the judicial role, a judge can be as crazy as he wants to be and be immune. I was alerted to a case recently out of Chicago, that ended up going to the 7th Federal Circuit, I believe. And a judge, duly appointed, sitting on the bench, had a job as a judge. He also owned some rental property. And he had a renter that turned deadbeat on him, as they say in the law, wouldn't pay his rent. He'd go through the judicial process, have him thrown out, and then he'd just come back and squat on the property. Well, the judge, one evening, went down to look at his rental. And lo and behold, here the squatter was still on the property, living in a sleeping bag or something there. And he was so incensed, and he carried a pistol with him. He was in Chicago, smart thing to carry a pistol. And the judge had a pistol with him, and he got the man down on the floor and put the gun to his head, and he said, "I've had enough. So we're going to hold court right here." And he said, "This is on the court's motion to show cause why I shouldn't throw you out. And do you have anything to say?" Of course, he didn't say anything. I wouldn't have said anything either. Wasn't the right time to talk. Sometimes it's just not right to say anything. And that was the time. He didn't say anything. So the judge said, "Well, you've had your due process, notice, and opportunity to be heard. So I'm ruling against you, and I'm going to bodily throw you out of the apartment." And he did. And this fellow had the temerity to sue the judge for a crime, wielding a weapon and all self-help. And amazingly, the court acknowledged that this judge is crazy, he's dangerous, he's a jerk, but he's a judge, and he, within his judicial role, he can do anything. Now, he could have sued him, or he maybe is liable for the prosecutor to be prosecuted for some kind of a wielding a weapon without cause. I don't know, whatever else, but he could have been prosecuted for. But as far as breaching judicial immunity, the federal court said absolutely not. And that's the extent of judicial immunity. As long as the judge is making judicial decisions and he is within the scope of his role as a judge, And I've read other cases that aren't quite as crazy, but they're bad decisions. Now, I've thought about in the past suing judges who had, I believe, had stepped out of the judicial role. I didn't do it, but I'll give you one example. Federal judge told the federal U.S. attorney that he wanted so-and-so prosecuted. And the U.S. attorney had come in and talked to him at different times on different cases. He'd sometimes ask him, well, what's the status on the grand jury investigation for so-and-so? And the prosecutor would tell him. Well, finally, the prosecutor got this fellow indicted after a few grand juries. And then nothing was known about it, but the prosecutor got worried later, months and months later, after the proceedings had started against this fellow, and filed an information notice saying, I just remind you, Judge, this was your idea, not my idea. And I think maybe you're conflicted here. I don't know whether the prosecutor maybe thought somebody knew something, wanted to clear themselves. Well, then the judge started stepping and fetching. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't remember. I do remember now that the U.S. attorney has said this to me. Maybe they'd arranged it between themselves, but he recused himself from the case. But, of course, if he had recused himself from the case, then the next thing was to move to remove the indictment for crimes. Conspiracy is what it was. And the motion was made, and the new judge recused. And I think the new judge was absolutely wrong. Now, that first judge that joined the prosecution team, in my view, that's stepping outside your judicial role. And that once you step outside your judicial role as a judge, you're naked. You're naked, and you're an open target. And if a smart judge won't do dumb things like that. As a matter of fact, see, that's also a violation of separation of powers. That was the judicial branch joining up with the executive branch, the Justice Department, to do something real nasty against due process against a fella, and they did that. Well, that may be some examples of what it means to leave your judicial role. It's very strong, this judicial role thing, but judges can leave it. I did read a case not many years ago about a woman who was fired from a judge's staff, and she sued the judge on the basis of, I don't know, equal opportunity or something. I had to do with skin color. Didn't make any difference, but sued the judge. And in that case, the court ruled that the act of firing and hiring staff was not within the judge's judicial role, and therefore the judge did not have immunity. And if he broke the law in hiring and firing clerks or whatever, office help, then if he violated the law in doing that, he was open to a lawsuit. He didn't have any immunity. He had stepped outside of his judicial role. So to sum up, if a judge is sitting on the bench and he has on a black robe and he's acting like he's a judge, I don't care how crazy he gets, he's got immunity. He may be able to appeal. You may be able to have him impeached and removed from the bench. It's say cussing on the bench, drunk on the bench. All these things have come up. Federal judges, Tom Jefferson, pushed for the impeachment of a federal judge that was drunk on the bench and cussing on the bench during an admiralty case, and had him impeached and removed. But he didn't go after him for having left the scope of his judicial role. Now, that's enough on that, Gerard, just to give people kind of an idea of what it is, maybe.
Okay, thank you, Brent. And Jan, the third question.
Okay.
Were these all from the same person or no?
No, they're all different people.
Oh, okay, just checking.
Yeah, no, we're not trying to hit you three times from one. Okay, this question is, I am in the process of replying to court filings in opposition. My question is, can I open a court of record from the Superior Court even after a disfavorable judgment? I am contesting unlawful foreclosure due to securitization of my loan and mortgage. And is there anyone at NLA that can help this fellow? He's new to legal proceedings.
Well,
go ahead, Brent.
I was going to say,
go ahead.
Yeah, this whole thing about court of judicial record seems to be coming up a lot. People trying to decide or arguing about what a court of record is. And, of course, it's important that the court is a court of record. But, again, I don't want it to be more complicated than it needs to be. If you record what's going on there, or the court records what's going on there, if there's a stenographer there taking down the words that are said, it's a court of record. That's it. If there is no stenographer there, then you can hire one, and you can make it a court of record. That's what a court of record is. Fundamentally, it's a court that makes a record of its proceedings. Now, there are other things that we can talk about that maybe apply to the definition, but there's no need really to go much further than that. If they're making a record, that's a court of record. That means there's a record you can appeal on. If there's no record to appeal on, then the right of appeal is pretty weak. You can still do it in some cases, but now some courts don't want the stenographer there to take a record because the judge doesn't want it written down what he says. Then other judges, and I've seen this happen before, you know what was said in court, you know the stenographer took it all down, but then you go to the record and you find out that the thing that you thought was important simply isn't there. Somebody got to the record and tampered with it. That's a federal crime, if it's a federal court, state crime, state court. You don't tamper with stuff like that. Happens, though. It does happen. Just like voter fraud, no, it happens a lot. It's always happened. And if it's your rights that are hanging in the balance, it's up to you to be aggressive and pay attention and make sure that a record is made. So in this case on foreclosure, if the court's not recording the words as they're said, then you have the opportunity to tell the judge you're bringing in the stenographer, or just hire one and have the stenographer show up and start recording things. And if the judge doesn't like it or wants to fight about it, he can tell you, I don't like that, I'm going to stop it, and then you can force. And then if the judge doesn't let you make a record of what's happening, then that's an appealable question. Maybe I would say, I've never faced this, but I would say that's interlocutory appeal. You can appeal that before the case is over, surely. Because if you don't, there'll be no record to appeal on. But I don't imagine it would go that far. I can't imagine a judge not saying, well, sure, you can record what's going on here. That's all the comments I had, Gerard.
Okay, thank you very much. Where are we here? Was that was the last question, Jan?
Right. That was it.
Okay, look, at when we go in, we have a little different opinion on a court of record. We believe that that's something that is required if you're going to be under common law. If you don't have it on the record, then you're in an administrative court or something else. You know, the jurisdiction that you're in, a lot of times it determines that. If you can't have a record, then what are we doing? You know what I mean? It's not. You know, so we always declare that it's a court of record, that's what we want. And, you know, Thornton teaches that, you know, when you go in and you open a court of record, what you're doing is you're the sovereign of the court. Now, we don't necessarily agree with that because God is the sovereign of the court, not you. And the tribunal, the jury, is the sovereign of the court. Of course, if there's no jury there, then guess what? If you're not agreeing to a equity administrative court, then I guess you're the sovereign then, right? The other side doesn't ask for a jury, or you don't both agree that the judge is going to be the tribunal, then you're it. But you don't see that too much. People don't know how to do that. And you know, the IRS makes sure that when they take you to tax court, they bring you into a court of record. It's that important to them. And, of course, people don't know to say that, look, you can't be the sovereign. There needs to be, the jury needs to be the sovereign. So that's the way I understood it, that it was an important premise to make sure that it was a court of record, so to speak. Because, you know, most of these administrative courts, you know, they do what they want. And that doesn't mean just because they're sitting there with a transcriber that it is, you know, you have a common law court, because a lot of them keep records. You know, you go to a DEC hearing and there'll be some transcriber there writing everything down as they railroad you. So it doesn't mean that you're not in an admiralty court or something like that, you know. Anyway, I don't want to beat that to death, but thank you. Okay. So that's the questions. You know what? I don't know if you prepared anything, Brent. If you want to speak for a little bit, and then I'll open up the queue for questions and answers. Okay. I don't know. Do you have something prepared?
Well, I get talk about the militia clauses. We're about through the material, but I would like to finish it. Just mention
yeah,
more
it's
about
942. Go ahead, and then I'll go on for whatever, and and then when you're done, I'll open up the queue and we'll take some questions and answers. So go ahead and finish up with that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, as the court of record, I wanted to make a comment about it. And following up to you, I agree with you. A court of record is important. But my point was more that it's important that a record is made. That's where the real power is. If you have a court of record, they're not making a record that you don't have anything to appeal on. And we need that. And it is important. It is the thing that differentiates us from the rest of the world, that we make verbatim records of what is said in court. That's because our trials in America are oral, spoken primarily, not written. If they're written, they're not public. It becomes a private or a secret tribunal. Mm-hmm. But so it is important. We don't disagree about that, just that I was making the point we need to do that. Well, I want to talk about the militia clause a little more. We've been at this now for several months. I'm going slowly and surely, sure-footedly through the militia clauses of our Constitution. There are four of them. And of course, the best-known militia clause of our Constitution is the fourth one, which is the Second Amendment to our Constitution. And I'd gotten down to the end, and I'd made the point that our militia clauses, if they were paid attention to, this police state culture, the us versus them, the fear of the police state of the people and the fear of the people of the police state would hopefully melt away to some degree, and there wouldn't be such bridges of hostility between the government and the people. I believe that obeying the militia clauses of the Constitution, the four of them, would go a long way to bringing us a little more unity than we have now. There's a concentration now in America of monopoly of domestic force, a monopoly of domestic force and violence. The police forces, the military now being used in our own country, that the Posse Comitatus Act is apparently not paid much attention to, not in force. And this is costly. It costs a lot of money to hire police forces, not only in dollars, but in destruction of freedom of association. Freedom to not only choose relationships, but also to nurture and keep them. Police forces are there, they're trained, and they want to do what they're trained to do. What are they trained to do? They're trained to bust heads. That's exactly what they're trained to do, or to kill, if necessary. And it creates a militaristic culture that is contrary, fundamentally, to our liberties. They want to exert the force. Most of them are young. The ones that aren't young become calloused. I've known a lot of retired police officers. You get calloused to what you're doing. It's not good business. They get too used to it. That's the problem. It ought to be self-evident to people that warehousing of non-dangerous men and increasingly of non-dangerous women in prisons, many of them, that if that bars them from releasing their energy, doing things that are worthwhile, taking care of their families, their children, all of that male energy, all of that female energy now locked up in prisons. It's an ugly, ugly state of affairs. And unless you've been inside one of those kinds of dungeon-type kind of places, it's hard to imagine how ugly and spiritually oppressive it all is. Mean and ugly. Well, the ties of otherwise productive relationships are broken by prisons. Broken. And freedom of association and relationships is the fundamental of all of our freedoms and all of our prosperity. And prisons are designed to destroy those fundamental ties of relationship from religion and family to business and government. And the criminal law industry, and it is an industry of incredible wealth, now wages war against our freedom of association in the United States, and that's the fundamental engine from which we get all of our all things that are good to us come through freedom of association, and our relationships, our fundamental relationships. Bottom line, your freedom depends upon the absence of government-enforced monopolies of private trade and of public trade. It's this monopoly of force and violence that is killing us to a great degree. I know there are other things too, but if we take away just one of those things, the police state attitude would go a long way. And the only way we can do that, I see, is to vitalize, to quicken the militia of the several states of our United States using the mandates of the four militia clauses of our United States Constitution. Well, it's hard for us to imagine really what went on when the country started. And we can read about it a lot. And the more we read about it, if we will, the more feel we can get, really, for what was going on. It's hard to imagine that at that time the cousins of the American colonies, the British people, had plans to wipe out the American colonies with the smallpox virus. And they had plans to vaccinate the slave population here in America and send the smallpox throughout the colonies and destroy our population. And it got so bad, people don't realize that's germ warfare. That's scorched earth policy. That's terrorism of the worst kind. That's demonic. That's what that is. That's what was planned for the colonies. And so we really didn't have any choice. People say, well, we shouldn't have rebelled. We shouldn't have fought against the authority of our mother country. All that. Well, that's really maybe fundamentally true. But then when they try to kill all of you, that was a plan. Somebody's got to do something. And so we did. And we separated ourselves from Britain. And ultimately, of course, Britain wasn't stupid. They wanted to remove our right, our responsibility of self-defense to keep and carry firearms. And so we struck back, as we should have, not as we could have. It was not an option. It was a responsibility. And I forever weary of well-known teachers in America. You hear them sometimes, saying that the American Revolution was against the will of God. And I won't mention names, but some of the best-known Bible teachers in our country say that. And men who are good at what they do, teach the Bible, they say that because they apparently maybe don't know history. But genocide is against God's fundamental law to be fruitful, multiply, and spread out over the land. Genocide, obviously, puts quite a monkey wrench in that part of our fundamental law. Well, I want to make one mention about our Constitution, because we're talking about the militia clauses, rules of interpretation, and then that'll be enough for this evening. The rule of interpretation of our Constitution, and those rules that ought to be used, are fundamental not only to our Constitution, but any writing of legal significance. And that would include, of course, the entire laws of nature's God, which Blackstone tells us is God's law written, our Bible. His will, the revelation of his person and what he wants, that's his law. And these are the fundamental principles and rules of interpretation of our Bible, of our Constitution of the United States, of statutes when we face statutes, any writing of legal significance. And these rules, we can find them used in the Bible itself, not to mention we find them repeated throughout the court opinions, whether it's the federal courts, the Supreme Court of the United States, of course, being at the top of that heap, or has been in the past, our state courts. Some people, over the years, this, hermeneutics. People say, Herman who? Well, Hermes was the reason we call it hermeneutics, the science. It's not really a science. It's the rules of interpretation. Hermes was a Greek god. The oil cans full of oil. ago, and I remember wings. He was a runner. And the reason he was a runner was because he was message carriers, messengers. And his name was Mercury, and the reason they called him Mercury, because Mercury, well, it looked, do that. It's very dangerous. But we go. Yes. They call it Mercury. But
Brent, you're breaking up real bad.
Well, I can fix that maybe. Hang on.
Oh, I thought that was me. That's why I didn't say anything.
No.
I'm like, what's wrong with this headphone?
Is that better? I hope it is.
I hit my machine with a hammer. No,
okay. Thanks for telling me. But at any rate, but this Roman god, Hermes, was a god that brought across the message. He carried the message. So hermeneutics became the word in the ancient world to speak of the rules of interpretations of writings. How do you get the message across? That's the question. Okay, let me get to these. And the framers of our Constitution were born and brought up in the atmosphere of the common law and thought and spoke its vocabulary. I'm quoting, by the way, the Supreme Court of the United States, Ex parte Grossman, 1925. The framers of our Constitution were brought and brought up in the atmosphere of the common law and thought and spoke its vocabulary. When they came to put their conclusions in the form of fundamental law and compact draft, they expressed themselves in the terms of the common law, confident that they should be, or could be, shortly and easily understood. Therefore, I'm quoting the same case, the language of the Constitution cannot be interpreted safely except by reference to our common law, as it was when the instrument was framed and adopted. Let me repeat the last part of that quote. From the Supreme Court of the United States, Ex parte Grossman, 1925. Language of the Constitution, said Chief Justice Taft, the language of the Constitution cannot be interpreted safely except by reference to the common law, as it was when the instrument was framed and adopted. That, friends, neighbors, and kin, is a rule of interpretation of our Constitution. Our Constitution leaves many key words such as dollars, militia, jury, due process. It leaves those words wholly undefined by our Constitution. It just mentions them. It says them. It uses them as though everybody who reads knows what they are talking about. And it leaves them undefined because in the 1780s, way back 230 some years ago, a long time ago, over 200 years, won't do the arithmetic in my head right now, but at that time, when it was ratified, all in America knew well the meaning of such words. Dollars, militia, jury, due process were the examples I used. To apply our Constitution aright, one must take such words as Americans then, at that time, understood the words of our Constitution, that is, according to our common law's first principles. According to our common law's first principles, it is my great ambition in life, and I don't know how good a job I do, but I want to learn how to do it more and more and get better at it if I can, to make things as simple as possible. I really do believe that Thoreau had it right. The key to living is three. There are three keys to living: an enjoyable life, a peaceable life. The first one is simplicity, the second one is simplicity, and the third one is simplicity. Simplify, 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 and everything is simple, said somebody smarter than me, I can't remember. Everything is simple, he said, once you understand it. And our common law is like that, and the more I wrestle with it, the more I worry over it, like a dog worries over a bone, and the more beautiful and simple it becomes. But you have to thrash through all the confusion that people have thrown up into your mind and all the confusion that all of us have been foolish enough to clog our brains with. The simplicity of the matter is, what did these words mean according to our common law back in the 1780s? Now, one way to find the answer to that question in any given instance is to read and ruminate Blackstone's four volumes of his commentaries on the laws of England, the laws of England published about the year 1765. And those four volumes were used more than any other reference in our courts from the beginning of our country until about the year 1890, 1900, along in there. Blackstone was quoted more than any other reference. So he gives us, Blackstone, in those lectures, some clear understandings about the words of our common law, but not all of them. It's a well-written, very well-written set of books, but he was not perfect. There are things he says in there that are flatly untrue. For example, he says that the common law does not apply in our American plantations. He said the common law doesn't apply in America. Well, of course, the Americans took umbrage with that. That's why we went to war with them over that simple point. We said, no, we are a common law country. Well, okay, let's go to our next rule of interpretation. And this is taken again from our Supreme Court, and it is our tradition. It is our customs that have been recognized through the centuries at common law. Where the words are clear and unambiguous, presume the easy, natural, straightforward sense of the words. Let me repeat that. Where the words are clear and unambiguous, presume the easy, natural, straightforward sense of the words. Simply put, I like this, to put it this way, if the common sense of the words makes clear sense, then take the common sense. If the common sense of the words makes clear sense, take the common sense. Of course, you have to know what the words mean to do that. You might want to look them up and see what they do mean. That helps. But then once you put them together, if it's a common sense question, go with the common sense. And the drafters of our Constitution were careful to put it in language that men commonly spoke. It's not for government. It's not written for lawyers. It's written for you. It's written for the American. Next rule of interpretation. If the words are unclear and ambiguous, do not separate the text from the historical background. For if you do, you will have perverted and subverted the Constitution, which can only end in a distorted, bastardized government. I'm quoting James Madison there. Let me read what Jim Madison said. He said, if the words are clear or ambiguous, no, let me repeat that. If the words are unclear or ambiguous, do not separate text from historical background. James Madison said that. He was telling us here in the future, do not separate text from historical background. If you do, you will have perverted and subverted the Constitution, which can only end in a distorted, bastardized government. Now, do we have a distorted government? Answer, yes. Do we have a bastardized government? Yes, it's absolutely and literally incestuous at this point, bastardized government. We have those. And the reason we have those is because where the words are unclear or ambiguous to us, we ignore the historical context and just do anything we want. Well, one more. I think there's just one more. And the rule of interpretation is this, and this is true of all writings of legal significance. Our Constitution has no superfluous words. And we are not to presume that any writing of legal significance has extra words that aren't needed. Thus, in order for our Constitution's lawful meaning to surface, to be seen, the common law meaning of no word or phrase can be ignored. As E.B. White used to say, every word must tell. Every word must tell. Don't leave any word out. I have done this. It's easy to overlook a word. It's easy to just kind of slide over it and say, well, that just fits in nice and get the sense. But now, wait a minute, back up. Every word must tell. What does that word mean? Why does he add that word there? Do not assume with writings of legal significance, such as our Constitution, believe me. The courts have done this, and it's a good thing they have. And when the men drafted the Constitution of the United States, they were careful. They were careful not to use more words than they need. As one fellow said, as a painting needs no extra strokes, as a paragraph needs no superfluous sentences, as a sentence needs no meaningless words, all of those things are true. And we are to assume that they were careful, the men that drafted it, to not put extra words in there. So don't slide over the words. Make sure they all have meaning. And every word be given due play. A good way to interpret the writing of legal significance is to read, take a phrase, take a sentence, read the sentence, and every time you read it, stress loudly one word of the sentence. For example, the Second Amendment says, a well-regulated militia. First time you read that phrase, say, a well-regulated militia. Now notice it doesn't say the well-regulated militia. It's just making a general statement of principle, a well-regulated militia. And then the next time you go through it, stress the next word, a well-regulated militia. Well, what does well mean? Think about that. Look it up if you need to. As simple as that word is, I do this. As simple as words are, like the word well. There's a word that's so small we take it for granted often. We don't stop to consider what it really means. Where did it come from? What's the etymology? Is it a Germanic word? Is it a Latin word? How was it used? How was it used at that time? Then the next time you read it, say, stress the next word. A well-regulated militia, like that. And that way, make sure you pay attention to each word. If you don't do that, I guarantee you, I don't care how educated formally you are or how high your intelligence quotient is said to be, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to ignore things. Leave something out that's going to make all the difference in the world. Regulated, what does that mean? Now, there's a word that's changed over the centuries. That which is regulated is that which is regular. That means it's free-flowing. It's good to go all the time. Those things are important. We have it also with the Commerce Clause, the regulation of commerce across borders. What is commerce? All those things need to be asked. Our Constitution is not an instrument for the government to restrain the people. It is an instrument for the people to restrain the government. Lest the government come to dominate our lives and our interest. That was from Patrick Henry, a quote, word for word. Let me read it again. And this pertains to interpretation of our Constitution. Patrick Henry is saying, if you don't keep this always in mind when you go to interpret the Constitution, you're going to make a mistake. What is it we are to keep in mind? That the overall purpose of the Constitution is not to restrain me, is to restrain those guys, those bureaucratic-minded government paychecked employees. That's what it's written to restrain. And we must always keep that in mind. Otherwise, we'll turn it around in our heads and we'll do some stupid things. And you can read court opinions where stupid things are said as though this is supposed to restrain me. Take, for example, the First Amendment, freedom of religion. That's used to restrain religion. It's not meant to restrain religion. Why? Nothing in our Constitution was meant to restrain anybody but government employees. But see, they've turned it on their head. And there are other examples of amendments to our Constitution that have done that too. That's contrary to the overall purpose of the document. Let me read it again one more time. Patrick Henry. And Patrick Henry, mind you, was against the Constitution of the United States. Keep that in mind about him as I read this quote. But he did recognize this. And he said it well. Our Constitution is not an instrument for the government to restrain the people. It is an instrument for the people to restrain the government, lest they come to dominate our lives and our interest has the government come to dominate our lives and interests? Certainly more than was intended, certainly more than freedom will allow at this point. One more statement. This is a quote from Tom Jefferson. He said, "Always remember the sacred rights of mankind." The rights of mankind, that means his responsibilities that God gave him. Fundamental rights, sacred, God-given. "The sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. They are written as with a sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of divinity itself, and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power." I want to read that one again too. "The sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. They are written as with a sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of divinity itself, and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power." Now, this is not to say that by rummaging among old parchments and musty records, and that's what our Constitution has become to many, it's not to say that doing that will not help incite in the human being that desire for freedom, because words will do that. It's important that we do not lose the sense of the words that are recorded on paper, that are the observations written down, recorded, of our rights and responsibilities. But I do agree with Tom Jefferson, of course. God has also etched these into our being because we are made out of the holy imagination of God. God imagined what we would look like. He imagined what we would be like in his mind, and then he made us to fit that image. That's what it means to be made in the image of God. That means we are the product of his sacred imagination. And he, by the way, tells us, forbids us from returning the compliment and making God in our imagination. That's the commandment against idolatry, the use of idols and trinkets in worship of God. Well, that's all I had for this evening, Gerard, just some rules of interpretation of our Constitution. To end with that.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. All right, well, the queue is open. You can get in there if you got any questions for Brent or myself. We have somebody in there. I don't know who it is. Let's see. I didn't turn it on, by the way. It went on. I don't think I did it, but nevertheless, it's on. So I think it's star one or pound one. Okay, we have somebody whose number ends in 1702. And what? You're unmuted. Give me a first name and your state. Go ahead.
My name is Donaldson. I'm in the state of consciousness. And I bid you all the best on this fine new year. I actually got a new phone, but my question is about the people and the sovereignty. Okay? Because I have pretty good knowledge. I mean, I guess if you consider the legislative analysis of the state legislature of California to be, you know, whatever they come up with to be law, like the statutes, right? That's the law for the government, right? So, in essence, you look at 11120 of the California Government Code, and it says that the people do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them, the people. And I remember you saying, Gerard, that the people aren't sovereign, or that somehow you couldn't go into court and use the argument that you are one of the people, and you don't believe that the people are sovereign, basically. I was wondering if you could explain that in context to 11120.
I don't believe the people are sovereign. My goodness, all them people that are accusing me of being a sovereign citizen and all that.
Excuse me, can you hold on 1 second, please, Brent? I'm sorry, Gerard, hold on one second.
What's the matter?
I just wanted you to hear the noise in the background. Listen, that's not me, okay? I don't know what that noise is, but I think you have another caller open, and they are making a tremendous amount of noise.
I don't hear it.
I don't hear it, Gerard.
Okay.
No, I don't.
It's gone away now.
Pretty quiet.
But
anyway,
can you continue talking? Thank you.
Yeah. I don't ever remember saying that the people aren't sovereign. All sovereignty rests in the people. That's a fundamental principle right there as far as our relationship to the government. You know, I mean, I don't know where you ever would have heard me say that the people are not sovereign, because that's
well, Bill Thornton goes into court with the people argument, right? We are one of the people, right?
No,
like, in other
says,
words, you go ahead.
He says that the sovereign of the court is you. You're opening up a court of record, and
that's
you're
true.
The sovereign.
But that's true.
That's true, except we're doing it under those laws that come from God. That's where they come from, whether you like it or not. They come out of the Ten Commandments. So, in effect, God is the sovereign of the court. I said of the court. The people are the sovereigns here on earth of the government. That's our place. God first, then the people. You see, humanists think that people can run themselves. There is an argument for the humanists that we don't need God, we don't have a creator, and that's not what our forefathers said and did. Like Brent said, if you read their writings in the context of the way they were understood, this government was under that being, the God of nature and nature's God. What does that mean? It means he's the sovereign when it comes to our relationship between God and man and ourselves, in between ourselves, because his law governs what we do amongst ourselves. Thou shalt not kill. That's, you know, that's above.
Right, but I mean, the error, hold on, the thing about that is that the error in that thinking is that it denies an atheist the right to freedom in America if they don't believe in God.
Doesn't deny him anything. No. He can have the benefit thereof, but he needs to accept that he can't go outside of those laws. And those laws, where do you find those laws? You find those laws in those writings, and they come from the Ten Commandments. I don't care if he's an atheist.
Well, then what happened to common law if you can't go into court and say, I don't have to tell you the truth because, you know what? The Bible says I have to tell you the truth, but I'm not a Christian. Okay, and you're making me believe in that and follow that doctrine.
I don't have to not murder.
America
my
is about freedom. Freedom really makes America great.
Whoa. Freedom is great.
God is awesome, but
excuse me. Wait.
Yeah.
Look, you have to have limits on freedom. You're only free. My kingdom ends where yours begins. So
yes.
if there's no limits on freedom, I just come over and kill you. I'm free to kill you. Yeah, I have a free will. I could kill you. Nobody can stop me. I could plot it and plan it and do it, but I'm going to suffer the consequences of that.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if you say I don't believe in that, so I don't have to tell you the truth. You don't have to tell me the truth, but you know what? You're going to suffer the consequences of lying, and lying has its own consequences that even. Law doesn't have to. You suffer those consequences from your neighbor, from yourself, by lying.
If the government is a satanic order, then lying to them is actually probably doing some good.
Oh, absolutely, I agree.
Yeah.
That's right.
So let me say something about the ambiguity argument real quick, because I know Mr. Winters brought up the argument of ambiguity, and I have been harping on that for quite a while. Syntax is super crucial. I believe that there's a lot of ambiguity in the Constitution, and it was in there on purpose because of the ability of the people to be able to think, you see, and really construe liberally and broadly the terms of the Constitution in the benefit and in the favor of the people, not to the benefit of the government. So if you know, a lot of it does come down to our own education, and you know, knowing the power of the word A, the reason why he brought up the word A was because A is basically an indefinite article, and the is a definite article. Because A, you only use A when you have actually never mentioned the subject matter before, and you would use the when you already know about the subject or whatever it is you're talking about. So it's really important to actually know the basics of grammar if you want to talk about any type of legislative analysis or the elements of a particular statute or constitution. But with regard to the void for vagueness doctrine, that's something valid, and people can use that if you can get the case law in your state that supports the claim. I say if you have a situation, see what you can do with that. That's excellent stuff right there.
Well, that makes sense to me. I'm not against what you said. It's important to know something about bonehead grammar. Get you an 8th grade grammar book. I consult bonehead grammar books once in a while just to buff myself up. But it is it's impossible to interpret the statute or the Constitution unless you're willing to follow the customs, and they are customs of speech as we record them on paper. And those, because we speak English and because our Constitution is written in English, it's important to stress each word, as I was saying. I think that's a good way to approach it, so that no word will be left out and no word will be brushed over, and every word must tell. And that's where we start with our Constitution. We don't need to make it over complicated. It is a brief, as we said a while ago, a brief of common law government. It is not an explanation of common law government. It mentions the doctrines. It doesn't explain them. It doesn't support them at all. It just says it. And if you don't understand something about the fundamental first principles of our common law, the Constitution is nothing more than a dry and dispirited skeleton of words. And it is, I would say, to 99.999% of Americans, and about 99.1% all lawyers. The common law is not, the first principles of it are ignored entirely. And the reason they're ignored entirely, because the recordation of those first principles set in clarity, such as, for example, Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, are ignored entirely. And the reason they're ignored entirely is because Blackstone, for example, the whole four volumes are shot through with negative comments about everything from Islam to Romanism and the law of the city and the canon law. And that's why they're ignored, because that is said now to be against what would they call it? Well, the common sensibilities of people. And I say that's sad. You mentioned a while ago, what about the atheists? There are no atheists. Who are we kidding? Atheism is on the tongue, but it's never in the heart, as Bacon said. Paul the Apostle says in Romans chapter 1, all men know of the Godhead. Don't let them tell you otherwise. Although it is true that a man can bury that knowledge so deep in rottenness and filth and sin, the transgressing of God's law, that he'll come to ignore God and say, and be foolish enough. The fool hath said in his heart, said the psalmist, there is no God. He is a fool. Now, it's not to go without notice that those that founded our country, our first fathers and our second fathers, the ones that put together and ratified our Constitution. There was no question about it. If you claim to be atheist, you had no part with government, you didn't serve on the jury, and you didn't hold public office. Let's be honest about our history. That's what they said, and the reason they said that, and the reason their laws said that, is because it's absolutely true that you cannot acknowledge law and government and freedom without acknowledging the God, the lawgiver, the only true lawgiver of all freedom and liberty, which only comes by his order and law. He made us, and that's what they recognized in those early days. Now I have a choice.
And
I
so
can
that's
say
the tradition?
You said
God is the tradition. Okay.
The Creator, Jesus Christ, is the tradition, the Creator of all things.
I got
has you. Has been handed down to us. It's our culture. It's what we've decided to cultivate and keep through the centuries, and America wouldn't be here without it. And so if people want to do that, they want to deny God, they want to be Islamic, they want to follow the law of the city, they want to get rid of the laws of nature's God, Oh, well, they can live here. God made them too, made them in his own imagination. And I'm not to abuse them, I'm to respect them. God tells me in his law to respect all men. But that does not mean that they're entitled to the same privileges and responsibilities of others. I was fascinated to read the Heller decision, which was really the only decision to establish the Second Amendment in the history of our country. No other decision. That was in 2008, Supreme Court of the United States. I'd encourage people to go and listen to the oral arguments. You can do that on the Internet. You can go to the Justia website, listen to those. But in that opinion written, Justice Thomas wrote a lot about how what would have happened to people that had his skin color if they had not had guns in early days, and how they, the history, and he went back and read how they had banded together to protect themselves, not only in this century and the last century, but even in the decades after the war, after the war for separation from Britain. They had the right, the duty, the responsibility given to them by their creator of self-defense, and they exercised it. And that meant, of course, in our day, that means firearms. And then also Justice Scalia, being Italian, he may, and being Roman Catholic, he made strong note to discuss the idea or the whole thing in England where at common law only Protestants were allowed to have firearms. Roman Catholics were not. Yeah, they were not allowed. Go ahead.
We are trailing a little bit off. Let me ask one final question to Brent before I have to get off the phone here. I know there's other callers. It's really about Brent or Gerard, the takings clause, okay, of the Constitution, and how that applies to, like, say, a police power, right? Let's say a local government, municipal under a charter, takes the property of an out-of-stater, right, who bought property there, and they used the local tax scheme to do it, which denied the out-of-stater the actual state law, right, because the municipal, they opted out, right? But so are they using their police power to do that? That's my question. Is there police power there for the tax, the taking of the property? If not, this is really going to help me with my remedy here. So I need the question answered.
Well, the police power is the power of the states. The only police power that the federal government has under the Constitution, regardless of what anybody says, it's simple. The only police power they have is on federal property, military bases, owned by the general government sitting in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. And the police power, again, that word police is important to understand. It's seldom discussed. It's from the word polis, the Greek word polis. It's a city law term, a term of the civil law that came out of the Greek city-states, police. And it has to do with, in our constitutional understanding, we've taken that word and said, well, here's what it means to us in our common law country. It means anything that regulates the health, education, and welfare of people. Health, education, and welfare. Therefore, state governments have the police power within the boundaries of their states to regulate the health, education, and welfare of their the people that live within the boundaries of their states. Therefore, the state government, under the police powers, the way our constitutional federalism, as they call it, operates, the division of power between the state and federal, the states have the power, the legislatures, to pass laws concerning the future, to control the behavior of men in the future. You're not allowed in some states, for example, to bring a hog into the state that has not been tested for hog cholera. You see, when the legislature says that, they're controlling the behavior of men in the future. You're not allowed to bring diseased fruit into California. If you try to go into California, they have stations where they'll stop and ask you if you got any fruit in your car. Well, that's controlling the future behavior of people. That is a power. That's incredible power. That's the police power. You must, all parents must send their, educate their children, not send them to some school.
Can I be, okay.
Until they're 16, that's
thank
the
you.
Police power.
Thank you. So I want to be more specific.
I haven't got to your question yet. Your question
okay.
was about the takings clause, right?
Well, no.
Go ahead then. You tell me what it is. Maybe I missed it.
So what it's really about is the... whether or not the they're using police power to keep my friend off of his property right now if they were a market participant, you see, because they were a market participant. The municipality became a market participant, but they were also, I'm thinking that they're also trying to use police power, which would be kind of conflicting. So I'm trying to get either one.
No, they're not trying to use. They're not trying to use police power. They are using the police power. They're saying that this is an eminent domain case, and that we can take this property for the health, education, and welfare of the residents of this state. We think it's more important for public use, the welfare of the residents of this state, than it is for your use. So, but the only thing, of course, they have to do under our Constitution is provide just compensation. That's the law.
But not if they're using police powers. That's why I'm asking about police powers.
No. It's all a part of the police power, but they have to give them just compensation if the law is followed, if they're their property.
Right. There's this fine line. If they're a market participant, right, then usually they have to be treated like any other corporation and give just consideration, okay, the government. But if they use police powers, that's different. You have to go in and sue in a judicial way, you see, because they're exercising the judicial arm of the government to do what they're doing if they're using police powers, you see.
Well, they're always using police powers. If it's state government or some juridical entity thereof, a county, a city, a village, then it's the police power, because they only have the power to act, but this is
Thanks
a broad
a lot.
Power. It's an unlimited power, the police power, for the health, education, or welfare. There's another very broad word. And the taking of private property for public use falls into that category. Eminent domain, they call it. Well, I think you went off. Gerard, you still there?
I just said thank you, Brent, but you didn't hear me.
Oh, no, I didn't. Yeah, I must not have.
No, it was my fault. I was muted. Anyway, thank you for that. The next questioner is New York Mike. Go ahead.
Yes, Happy New Year, everybody. Great show again, as always.
Yeah.
Okay, I have just a quick question here. I was watching the law program, The Practice, which I enjoy because I like to see the unethical behavior of these attorneys. There was a statement made by James Spader. He was talking to his client in the back of the courtroom. A little girl ran up to him and demanded that she be kept here in America against her parents' wishes. And he yelled to the judge from the back of the courtroom, he wants a rest ipsa dozi. Do you have any idea what that term means? A res ipsa dozi.
No.
It's not
you
in the black box.
I don't have a clue, but I wish, of course, we'd get rid of all those foreign words and it'd help all of us. We wouldn't be asking these questions, and I'm almost mad that lawyers continue to use them. But there are some concepts bound up in those words that you couldn't get across any other way because we don't have any words in English to communicate them. I don't know what that is. You wouldn't have any idea how to spell it because all you heard was it spoken, right?
You're right. It was R-E-S for res, and then IPSA, I-P-S-A, and he said dozy. So
well,
I looked up under a whole bunch of different spellings under dozy with the U, and I couldn't find it anywhere in the dictionary at all.
Well, res.
He could have said forthwith. I think forthwith would have meant probably the same thing. I'm not sure.
Res, I think, if it's R-E-S, it means a thing or a matter. It just means thing or matter or property. And ipsa, it's a common foreign legal word, like res ipsa loquitur means the thing speaks for itself. It means itself, I suppose. The thing, res ipsa, itself, loquitur, speaks. The thing speaks for itself. Well, this is res ipsa something. You don't know what it is. The thing for itself something. I think probably it sounds like, though, he just hollered out to the judge and says, I don't have to make an argument here. You saw what happened. This girl made her point, and so it speaks for itself, but I don't know what the rest of it was.
Right, right. I was just curious if you guys ever heard of that.
No, I never have. A lot of weird stuff out there. I had a lawyer say one time, I said something in court, and he said, "Your Honor, that statement de-whores the record. De-whore." And I thought, what in the world does that mean? I thought he was making it up. I went and looked it up. Sure enough, it's a legal term. It's a Norman French term. The Normans brought to England. And whore, the word whore, not W-H-O-R-E, but H-O-R, is related to our word horizon. What he was saying was that what I said was outside the horizon, the boundary of the record. And so it had to be disregarded.
Wow.
Just keep learning. There are a lot of foreign languages out there in our legal tradition. And a few lawyers know them all. I don't.
It's hard enough to know the English language, let alone all these foreign stuff.
That's right. That's right. I agree 100%.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That's all. I yield. God bless you all.
You.
Happy New Year to everybody. Okay, later.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank
bye.
You, Mike.
Yep.
Hey, Brent, you said something before I was curious about. You said that Patrick Henry denied or went against the Constitution once. What was that? Is that what you said?
I never heard that. Well, Patrick Henry was famous for saying about the Constitutional Convention that he smelt a rat. Smelt a rat.
Oh, yeah, I have heard that. Yep.
I smell a rat. He was against it, and he said it was going to give the feds too much power. And amazingly, I think we see that he's been justified in his statement. It doesn't in and of itself give the feds too much power, but somehow it's been allowed to do that. I can't say that the Constitution, and I don't say that it's a bad document. I like it. If we would simply follow its limits for government and force government to follow it, we'd be in pretty good shape. But that's not happening. One of the things that we have in our Constitution that people were exceedingly afraid of, above all things, was the federal courts. And I think they've been justified and vindicated and proven right. The federal courts are not something people can control. The justices are appointed by the president. It's a political appointment, clearly, in every case. And the only way, of course, you can get rid of them is impeach them, and that has happened some through the decades, and it needs to be used more. But the courts have been the great, they have incredible power at this point, more than was ever intended, more than anybody ever wanted. The state courts are decent by comparison, and that's my evaluation, just having observed them both. You stand a chance in state court. In federal court, it seems that all they ever do is vindicate the federal government. That's been my observation, for whatever it's worth. And, of course, the federalization of criminal law is just so plumb out of hand. The founders would scream bloody murder if they could be here to see it. They never intended that. Almost 6,000 federal statutes, federal criminal statutes, and our Constitution only provides 4 kinds of crimes that the federal government can enforce. These 4 kinds of crimes are counterfeiting the current coin and securities of the United States. That's number 1, counterfeiting. Number 2, piracy and felonies committed on the high seas. Number 3, violations of international law. Number 4, treason. Those 4 and no more, those 4 are it. But yet, because there wasn't more criminal jurisdiction given in the Constitution of the federal government, yet almost 6,000 federal crimes on the books. And it's so far out of hand now that it would take a catastrophic effort to get rid of the madness. You know, I used to read these old cases, Gerard or whoever else listening, our old cases from federal grand juries and the charges of judges, the federal grand juries. And it didn't dawn on me until years later, and I said, wait a minute. I never read one charge to a grand jury that wasn't about an admiralty law case. Admiralty law. Right. Or felonies, piracy. Well, that's because until 1900, the federal courts didn't have anything to do but deal with admiralty. That's all there was. There were no federal crimes. Federal government didn't interfere in people's lives that much. The police power of the federal government only pertained to federal military bases and federal courthouses and the federal territories. And of course, the District of Columbia. And now those police powers are extended to, they're trying to, and the confusion is outlandish, of course. Drug laws are the big ones now, but there are a lot of others. You can't even, I know this sounds crazy, a man can't even walk out into the woods and take a leak without violating the statute that carries a possible 20 years. That's right. And every once in a while, it's invoked against people. You release any deleterious material into the quote-unquote environment, and you're guilty of a felony that carries 20 years thanks to Al Gore when he was senator, pushed that through. And I know men that have gone to federal prison because somebody found an expended paint can laying in a fence row behind their house. That's fact, under that statute. So the federal government doesn't have jurisdiction to do that. Where in the Constitution does it say that they have jurisdiction to pass some kind of a crazy statute about deleterious material in the environment? It doesn't. And it's destroying us. Well, that's just one of the ways that if we just confined our government activities to the limits of our Constitution, we would be more practically free.
Well, I guess you must have missed when they put us all out on the ship, huh? Anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of it is education, too, because we've been dumbed down in the language. And, you know, it's like the difference between the federal government to regulating or making regular commerce. You know, it's that play on words, and people aren't smart enough to make the difference, you know.
Good. Yeah, good point. It's just like Satan in the Garden of Eden. Did God really say that, or did he mean this? Or and then the confusion kind of... Yeah,
you mean,
true
you mean
words.
Bill Clinton? Yeah. What is the meaning of it? No.
Yeah, we laugh because we don't know what else to do, but that's really devastating. There's no question now. We lose the meanings of words. We lose our lives, our liberties, and our properties if we lose the meaning of words.
Yeah. I think Bill was smarter than we gave him credit for, because I think in my mind where he was going is he was saying, what is the meaning of is, because they had that term in the Bible, he who is. So in his mind, it's like, it depends on who you believe God is, I think. He could
wow,
have been,
maybe,
I,
yeah.
You know, it depends on what you think the meaning of is. Well, if is, he who is it, you believe is God, well, then I can't do it. If not, then guess what? I'm free to do what I want, right? Anyway, later I got thinking, saying maybe this guy, you know, really playing the word smarter than we gave him credit for.
Well, but, they didn't call him Slick Willie for nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
That was his nickname in most of his life.
I remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
So next question is Kansas Jan. Go ahead, you're unmuted. Thank you, Paul.
Well,
by the way.
Okay. Hi. I want to disagree with Brent, but. And I wrote it down because, and it's going to be kind of, I'm going to have to double back on myself, you know, using words, and didn't have enough time to really think it through. I'm studying trusts, and what I wanted to say, Brent, is that a right is not always a responsibility. It is also a just claim of something that belongs to you, such as property, or as in the case of the Declaration of Independence, where we, the people, small p, are the beneficiaries of the endowments, gifts, donations of the donor, creator, whose name is nature's God, and where we are the beneficiary of those endowments donated by the donor, which the presence, now here I'm going off onto another thought, but hang with me, which the presence of a creator donor, and number two, endowments, and number three, rights to use those endowments and donations conferred, prove that, and with no consideration exchanged, proves that a trust agreement was formed and not a contract, which would require such consideration, not endowments, which are gifts, And finally, now here's the third point. I hope you can make sense of this. And finally, the beneficiary's participation within the trust is limited to the right to use the endowments, gifts, or donations such that there is no responsibility on the part of the beneficiary at all as the receiver of the gifts and donations given by the donor. And so that without the element of the exchange of considerations, which is necessary for a contract, no contract exists, but a trust does. And so there was a whole lot of points wrapped up in that. But my real point, you know, that I disagreed with you on was that a right is not always a responsibility.
Well, I appreciate you. You're looking into this real lively, and I appreciate you bringing that up. You gave me a chance to bolster my point a little more. And a right, when I say a right is a responsibility, I start with the word. What does the word mean? And the word fundamentally is an Anglo-Saxon word, and it's a Germanic word. It's an old Germanic word. It was made popular in the German speech during World War II when Hitler talked about the Third Reich. That's our word right, R-I-G-H-T. They spell it differently. But throughout the history of the Germanic speech, the word right, and it's still a Germanic word, we have it, the word right means duty. It means responsibility. They have another word. They have another word, a couple other words that pertain to law that are different. But the word right means responsibility. It means duty. When you say, for example, that a beneficiary has a right because he has been endowed with an endowment or a gift by a trust settlement, a trustor, a settlor has settled a trust, if he is given that gift becomes his responsibility, and he'd better deal with it the way the lawgiver wants him to deal with it. That's God himself. He has become steward. And that's the meaning of that Germanic word. In one of my book on comparative law, I have a long footnote about the word right. And I want to interrupt you there, though,
if I may, because what you just said about the stewardship is the responsibility of the position of trustee within the trust and not of the beneficiary.
Let me back up again. No, you're right when you say you're right when you say that. There's that word right again. But if a gift has been given and the beneficiary does have a right to a disbursement, for example, a right to a disbursement, or if a disbursement is made, if it's a fully discretionary trust, he has a right to it. That right is responsibility. That's what that word means. That's what that word always means and should mean in every use. I understand the point you make, but still,
still disagree with you because it doesn't. It is a dispersion. You know, they can disperse the right. They can disperse the endowment, gift, or donation that the donor conferred upon them. But it's up to the trustee, as owner of the value of the estate or the trust, to handle it and be the guardian of it. So,
well, let me back up.
I disagree with you.
Well, let me back up. The trust, the trustee owns the property. He owns legal title. But the beneficiary owns beneficial title, whatever, how much ever has been given to him. He has a right in something. He has a right.
Yes, he has the right to use what's been conveyed into the trust.
Only if it depends on the terms of the trust, how and when and where. But still, the beneficiary has a right. And if he has a right, that right is a duty. That's the meaning of the word.
I disagree.
Well, I know you do, but I'm telling you what the meaning of the word is.
About
it.
I'm just
because
putting it out
is,
there.
Once you're given a right, you're responsible for it, and you must use it lawfully.
Well,
so
you know, we're not simplifying it enough because you're talking about trustees and trust and beneficiaries. If you take it down to an infant who God gave life to, that infant has a right to that life. You cannot take it. But that baby also has a responsibility as he's not, look, we don't let people commit suicide. He has a certain duty as he grows to do those things that were bequeathed that he should do with that life that was given to him, with that talent, so to speak. So maybe we're getting too
big. Well, you make a point. You make a point, well, Gerard, and life is a gift, just like an endowment from an inheritance or a trust or a will.
Right.
Life is a gift, and when it's given, it's a duty. All rights are duties.
So that baby's parents are the trustee until he's old enough to take care of it himself, at which point
then he has his own free will, and it's by his consent that things are done, which is how our governance is set up as well. So, I mean, I don't really want to take up time arguing about it. I was just putting the point out there for the people that are listening. I mean, we can disagree on it. You guys can say, you know, can continue all night saying that rights are responsibilities, but I'm still going to contend that a right does not always carry a responsibility with it, and that even Gerard,
I think you are right, because that infant doesn't have any responsibility until such time. How can he be responsible for anything in an infant state? We're splitting hairs on the situation here.
Splitting hairs. We're making sure that both sides are heard, that a right is sometimes different than the right that carries a responsibility or duty with it. Sometimes, as in the case of a donor gifting someone, they do not have a responsibility. They have free will, and they give consent. And if they fritter it away or shoot themselves in the head, you know, with a suicide, as with the gift of life, it's entirely up to them. You know, I mean, I'm just making a different point than what you guys are making. That the definition of a right is broader.
Let me drive that home. If you're given an option and you can exercise discretion, will, then that is your responsibility. You can't escape it. A right is a responsibility. Somebody gives me a gift.
I'm
trying to tell you a story to illustrate the point.
I don't want to hear the story. I want you to hear what I'm saying.
Well, we've done that, and I'm making the point. A right is a responsibility, and if it isn't.
No, a right is a responsibility to you. But
no,
I'm saying that there's a different definition of a right.
No, it's
Brent.
Is,
you're just
it,
trying
it
to force something
no,
that
I'm,
isn't there. You're trying
I'm
to force
gonna,
a definition
no, no,
that isn't
I don't
there.
Want, I don't
Sir,
want
you're trying to force a definition
right.
that isn't
As
there.
I said, God says rights
we can keep talking over each other and being rude, or
well, then,
we can
no.
hear each other.
A right is a responsibility, and it's just downright foolishness to say anything else. And I'm not going to allow people to say that and let other people hear it and let that be an option. It's not an option. If you're given a responsibility, you have a duty, period. Am I still there, Gerard?
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
Oh, okay. If you're given a responsibility, you have a duty. And to allow people to say otherwise, I don't want people to air the opinion otherwise, because it's false and it's against our law to say otherwise. And just because somebody wrote something about a trust and said that's the way it is, that doesn't mean that's the way it is. And I'm not just saying what I think, I'm saying what our law is and what it has always been. It's not a matter of opinion. It's not an option. And to say that a right is accompanied by a responsibility is false also. A right is a responsibility, and again, one more time, I go back, it's the fundamental meaning of the word, has always been the fundamental meaning of the word, and in popular culture, especially since the Civil Rights Movement, it's been perverted to point out, to say, to put across the false idea that rights are something that we can selfishly deal with. We can't. We're responsible for the rights we have, and that's part of our problem. We've seen them, because of the perversion of words, we've seen them as something other than responsibility, something that is selfish. Well, I have a right to this, and I have a right to that, and then ignore entirely what the word means. Anyway, that's all I had to say on that, Gerard.
Am I there?
No, that's all I had to say on it. I wanted to make the point.
Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah, North Carolina, yeah. April.
Okay. Well, I wanted to say something quick about what she just said. The way you're saying it, all that came to my mind was all rights carry responsibilities.
And that's a common phrase that I've heard all my life, too.
Yep.
I see. Yeah, I see what you're saying. But all rights are responsibilities. That's the
difference. They are. I agree. Can I ask a couple questions? Is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure.
Okay, one, do you have an email address that I can ask questions when they come to mind? Is there an email address?
Yeah, you can. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm jumping all over. I guess she's talking to you. Go ahead.
No, there are two. I suppose NLA has a website. You can also email questions to commonlawyer.com if you want.
lawyer.com?
www.commonlawyer.com.
Okay. Okay. My question, I had two questions, well, a couple actually. One is there, do you know any way that I could sue CPS or do something about them keeping me from seeing my grandson?
Well, you're in one of the Carolinas, you say?
My grandson is in CPS in North Carolina, but right now he is in guardianship of another grandparent in Virginia.
Oh, yeah, that's a... the only way you're going to deal with that intelligently is either find a lawyer in that jurisdiction that can deal with it because you're going across state lines. You need counsel. But if you don't have that, you can try to navigate it yourself. But I wouldn't know how to do it. No, I'm not from there, and I don't know the customs and the laws of those states.
Okay. Are there any, like, do you know of any anything in the Constitution or any case law that could help me with the way they're discriminating against me?
Well, yeah, but I don't know exactly how they're discriminating against you, but
I'm handicapped, and when we went to court, there were four sets of grandparents. I'm the only grandparent they put on the stand and questioned about me being handicapped, and they also don't want me saying to my grandson that his father loves him, and they're alienating his father from communicating with him, and because of that, they are keeping me on supervised visitations, and I have nothing to do with the case.
Now, this is your son or your grandson? I didn't catch
my grandson.
Oh, I see. Now, are you the responsible for providing for your grandson?
Well, this is what happened. The mother and my son had joint custody. The mother was married to someone else, and they committed a crime against another child and had all the kids taken away.
Uh-huh.
And the children were placed in CPS. Now, my son had joint custody, but CPS here completely ignored the fact he had joint custody and ignored the fact that he stated he wanted his son to be raised by me if the mother does not have custody. Now, they took her custody rights away. They said they can't take my son's rights away, but because my son's incarcerated right now, they're not even letting my son talk to his son. They won't let him have any communication with him whatsoever. And they're alienating him, and they're discriminating against me because they don't want me telling him, your dad loves you. They actually made comments about me saying that.
Well, certainly, that's an egregious. But that's pretty convoluted case. There's a lot of relationships there. That's why I say to untangle all that. And you're talking about what your position as a grandparent. I don't know what the laws of those states say, and all states are different on that point.
Right. So yeah. What would I look up to further myself with this?
Pardon?
What could I look up to further myself with this?
Well, you get on the internet and type in some keywords. Type in, for example, do you have internet?
Yes.
Type in grandparents' rights. Just start there. And as you start to read, you may start to catch some things that are analogous to your case, you know, facts that they talk about that are like your case. And as you do that, and you begin to pick up some law and type in the state of North Carolina, or whichever Carolina applies, grandmother rights, grandparent rights, and the handicap. You know, just use keywords. and right. see what you come up with. But I still say it's good to do your own research. There's no question. And you can help right. if you have a lawyer, you can help him with that. That's true.
No, I couldn't even afford a lawyer right now if I wanted
that's
to.
Usually,
I have to do it myself. Yeah.
That's usually the problem, but go ahead.
Well, here's my second question with that, is that I have a power of attorney with my son. So they're uh-huh. supposed to give me all paperwork, including the judge's orders, and they are refusing to accept my power of attorney, and they're refusing to give me any paperwork whatsoever. And my son is incarcerated, so he can't do anything about it.
Uh-huh.
Is there anything I can do about them not giving
you
me
have
paperwork?
You have power of attorney for your son, is that what you said?
Right.
And your son is in jail, is that right?
Right.
And you want paperwork from who?
I want the court orders, everything they're supposed to send to him, which they're not sending to him.
Okay. You have to go, then you can go to the court and get copies of those orders. You don't have to.
How do I do that?
Well, I don't know what court he was in, but whatever court he was convicted in will have the record of his case. That should be a public record, and you can go to the clerk of that court and ask them for copies of orders or copies of the file, and if you pray for them. Yes,
I think she's talking. I think she's talking about the papers that he's supposed to get in relationship to his son, that they're not sending to him in prison, not his case.
She wants
the judge's orders that's supposed to go to the father because he's the father, but he's in prison,
okay.
So of course they think he doesn't have any rights, right?
Right.
So
well,
she
still,
wants to get that paperwork.
Uh-huh. Well, still, that should be public record in the court. That's court record, as we were saying a while ago.
Well,
there's a record.
In family court, they don't release stuff because it's family court, personal stuff. But she has power of attorney.
Uh-huh.
She's the grandmother.
She should be able.
She needs an attorney.
They're ignoring power of attorney. They're ignoring it completely.
Did you go to the court and present the power of attorney to see if you can get the records?
I gave a copy to the lawyer. I gave the copy to CPS. And the judge is aware of it, and they're all saying that the CPS lawyers are saying that they don't have to give me copies of anything.
Well, the only remedy you have is to go into court and then see if you can get a judge to force them to do it.
So what would I file?
You can go to legal aid because
based on your income.
Not here, I can't. Legal aid here, you know what they do? They send you to a clinic. You sit down and listen to somebody, and like 20 people are there, and they give you paperwork, explain to you what you have to do, and that's it. They don't help you.
Oh, well.
Well, then, the only other thing you can do is see if there's a, I don't, again, know what it is in Carolina, but there are lawyers who are required. Lawyers are required to do bona fide work a certain amount every year. I don't know what it is in the Carolinas. You find a lawyer who needs to do some bona fide pro bono type work.
Yeah.
Pro bono.
See
if you can.
I've been trying that.
Keep trying. I know it's not easy. Keep trying. It's out there.
And her problem is she's working between two states. It'd be easier to get a lawyer in the state where they're holding your son, CPS, and use that lawyer to get the paperwork, because the lawyer in your state got a problem because he's not in the state that your son's in. So you got a lot of hurdles there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. Well, here's my other hurdle. besides everything I'm going through with my son, they took his keys and confiscated them as contraband because he had string holding it together. Is there anything I can do about that?
Now, repeat that again. What about contraband?
They took his keys and they put it in his, what is that called, his things, and they won't let him have it. They're saying it's contraband because he has string holding it together because they refuse to fix it.
Right. Well, now, if he's in prison,
right.
a state prison, it's very difficult to force them to do anything. And he would about have to deal with it inside prison and follow the channels there and see if he can work through it. This has been my experience. I'm not saying things are right, and that's the way it should be. Now, If you try to put pressure, pardon?
I know it's not right.
Yeah.
He's been in there 4 years, and they have done nothing but terrorize him.
That's the life of a prisoner. And if people realize what the life of a prisoner was like and the hellishness that goes on,
yeah,
then some of this incarceration will stop.
Yeah, my son was railroaded, and he had everything from being punished because he didn't take a deal. He had witnesses threatened. His trial was about a year later. He was forced to take a judge's trial, not a jury trial. And they had no credible evidence against him, and they also coerced the jury into what to decide, and my son got 73 years for crimes he didn't do.
Boy, that's a sad story. My heart goes out to you.
Well, he's also autistic,
like
bipolar,
yeah.
And he's also suicidal, so this is real hard for me, but I got to keep fighting because I got to get him home.
Well, let me encourage you, if I can, to be steady, steady as she goes. Don't get in a hurry. Do what you can. Take it a step at a time. Get on the internet. Never before have we had more opportunity to learn as quickly as we can today. And, do the best you can. How old is he?
He's 34.
They get away, the prison system, all of them, there's no law. They aren't governed. There is no freedom without law, and they are doing all they can to operate outside of the law. That's why we're all concerned, of course. That's why I suppose that John and Gerard have these calls, and I appreciate you taking time to tell me about it and the situation and alert me to it. And my advice is, if you can get a lawyer, if you can find somebody to take an interest in the case, use them. If not, just steady as she goes and keep plugging away at what you're doing, trying to learn about how to handle the situation, and just bite off a little bit at a time. Don't try to do it all at once. It's not possible.
Yeah. Well, that's my last question to you.
Well, thank you for calling. Yeah.
One more quick question. Is there anybody, because I'm going to do a habeas corpus with him, and I want to do a lawsuit. Is there anybody, as I'm going along, because I'm not doing it yet because I want to learn, I'm finishing my courses first. Is there anybody that can guide me when I get to that point, that if I have questions on what I need to do?
Well, Gerard, I'll give it over to you. I know you fellows have done a lot of work in that area. Do you have something you can help
with? We stopped doing habeas corpuses because we had too many, and we could only bring them up to the default stage. But all that information is still on our site. You know what I mean? You can learn how to get the examples and how to write them and stuff. And at some point, you know, somebody will start doing them again. I don't know when. I don't want to promise you anything, obviously. But, you know, if you get in and you go into the chats, I mean, there's other people in NLA that are familiar with the habeas corpus that might be able to help you. But we have the examples online. You know what I mean? You can teach yourself somewhat and see how.
Yeah, I've been watching them. I've been looking at them. And with the ones you have online, is it okay for me to use, like, words that you have in there and case law that you have in there?
Well, yeah, you could use the case law. The only thing is the habeas corpuses that we did them from the perspective of the grand jury. And so if you're going to do it yourself, you have to do it from the perspective of you. We granted it as the grand jury. Usually you go in and you petition the judge for the habeas corpus. Now, John did one and did it himself as a court of record where he did it, you know, as a next friend. And it did work. It did go through. That's the one that the guy actually got out of jail. So. But it's
now,
the same thing that we got on there. You just have to change the wording. You can't call yourself the grand, you know, the common law grand jury or whatever.
Do I go as the next friend, being that I'm his mother and I'm in a different state?
You have no other way of going but as the next friend.
Okay.
That's the only way they're going to allow you to do it anyway.
And if it goes before a judge at any point, and my son wants me standing there helping him because, like I said, I don't know if you heard me, he's autistic bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going as a special master or something?
No, because if you're a next friend, you're going to be filing the paperwork and everything. You know, if it gets to the point where you're standing in front of a judge, that means you probably did pretty good. So I don't think you need to worry about that at that point. You know what I mean? That means that they're actually listening to your paperwork and you're going to get some kind of hearing, which they probably wouldn't do unless they were going to grant it, right? So I wouldn't worry about that part, okay?
I plan on winning when it comes because I'm not giving up.
Well, that's good. You got a good attitude, and we'll pray for you because that helps. Prayer is a big thing. And look at also the thing that, Brent, when you're doing your research, look at your area and in that state for groups that do these, grandparents groups, you know what I mean? People have problems, and you may get some resources and people to help you there. There are people in local areas that do an awful lot of stuff. You just have to find them. Okay?
I've been trying to. I've been actually putting ads on Facebook for people that want to come in and start a group with Learning the Constitution with me.
Right, and there are parents groups and grandparents groups and all kinds. And now don't forget to look in the state where he is, not only your state, but look in that other state too. And you know, maybe you can get something going between, you know, your state and the people in that state. I don't know. Maybe God will break something loose for you. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm praying He does.
Yeah.
Is there a way for me to find out codes and rules CPS goes by?
Oh, you know what? It's an administrative court. I don't know what they go by. I don't even know. I don't even know if they go by what they go by. You know, they're so bad.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I don't know what their rules are or even where you find it or if they really have rules like that, because they are giving, if you read anything on them, they're giving very wide berth because it's a family court, you know? And and believe me, they take advantage of that. So, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know where you would find that, and maybe I'm remiss in that. Maybe I should know, but I don't. And I mean, let me tell you right now, that's the hardest and the worst law to practice is that family law practice. It's really bad. And they're, you know, look at, it is a criminal justice system. That's why they call it that. So anyway, thank you. And,
okay, thank you, and Happy New Year to y'all.
Thank you.
Happy New Year. Yep.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, next question is...
Hi.
Terry, yes.
I got a question about jurisdiction. This is a funny thing that happened to me several years ago. It was a motor vehicle thing. And what I was wondering is a conviction valid if the judge never asked you to enter a plea? And let me give you a little background on this. It was a motor vehicle issue, and at my initial appearance, the judge called me up, and I did something that he didn't like, which was I started to ask him questions about the allegations, you know, the nature of the charges, and so that set him off, and he immediately threatened to incarcerate me. So, long and short, you know, he doesn't even bother to ask me to enter a plea. He didn't enter one for me. And so, finally, we go to trial, and I say to the judge, you know, you never asked me to enter a plea. And he got in a little huffy and said, well, we're not going to go through this now, and proceeded with the trial. Now, I know at that point I probably should have said I object, but, you know, I didn't know then what I know now. And so I'm wondering, you know, would this be a valid conviction if you try somebody without even asking them to enter a plea and then, you know, convict them?
Well, I think it would be valid, wouldn't it, Brent?
It would be a valid conviction, you say?
Yeah.
No, a valid complaint for him, not a conviction.
Oh, no, yeah, certainly.
Look, they can't do that, but even though they do, but you'd have to bring it up. And you'd have to bring the record forth. I didn't mean to step on you, Brent.
No, that's all right.
But go ahead. You're the lawyer. I'll be quiet. But go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm just going to say I'm looking at it from a common sense standpoint. You did raise the question.
That's
you
right.
You didn't say I object, but you did object because you raised the question. It's on the record, as we're saying a while ago, I hope they had a stenographer there taking things down so you have that's a meaningful court of record. It's one thing to have a court of record, but you want to make sure a record is made. And if they did, of course, by now, maybe, you said it was several years ago, I'm sure the time for appeal is over. But it is important that the judge ask you that so that you can register verbally again. It must be oral in America. This is a common law country. We have oral trials and oral pretrial proceedings, and he needed to hear from you whether you pled innocent or guilty. Of course, but then on the other hand, if he went ahead and tried you, he or the court, however he did it, jury, that presumes a not guilty plea. And of course, in your state, wherever it is, I'm sure there's plenty of cases on the books and appellate opinions that address that question. And if you got on the internet, typed in the name of your state, and typed in, must the defendant have an opportunity to enter a plea, I'm sure you'd be overwhelmed with what you came up with. If you aren't, I'd want to know about it, but I bet you'd find some cases that were written that address that question.
Well, that's kind of what I'm planning to do, because I think actually that the conviction would be a legal nullity, and therefore it would not be valid, and that if it's a legal nullity, you can have that overturned any time.
Yeah. Well, I'd be anxious to know what you find out. Email me and let me know.
What's that?
Email me and let me know what you find out.
Okay.
You know, tell me yes or no, and not to send a long email. I'm just curious to find out if that's true, if you found that to be true in the courts of your state.
Well, I'll look it up. I'll see what I can find. I haven't found anything yet, but I think common sense would tell you that it would be a legal nullity, even though I did appeal it. And, of course, the judge wiped his butt with it like they always do. But I may take some action against this judge anyway. I don't know what, but I'll figure something out.
Well, good talking to you.
You too.
Okay, thank you. Next question, John Ward. You have been unmuted.
Hello, Gerard and Brent. Good evening and Happy New Year. I appreciate what Brent was saying earlier on Thoreau. Simplify. Now, I have looked up this definition in the dictionary, and I'm sure it's fairly common term that we in this community have heard of before, but it's anything but Thoreau in simplicity. The term is holder in due course. Now, what it says in the dictionary, it says one other than the original recipient who holds a legally effective negotiable instrument and who has a right to collect from and no responsibility toward the issuer. How's that for simplicity?
That's pretty simple.
Could you explain that a little bit?
Well,
and the reason I'm asking that is how that can be interpreted in terms of documents that we need, or at least I need, or should have, to determine the exact situation with property. Since we have, I think, through identity theft, have been defrauded of our property, or at least they think they have accomplished the fact, I hope they haven't, then in order to research this and determine exactly what documents we need to be assured that we have enough and the right documents to say, hey, this is my property. These are the documents that determine that certainty. That's at the root of my question.
Well, do you, is this question, this problem you're having, does it include or somehow implicate some negotiable instruments, checks or notes, promissory notes or something?
Well, when of course the when you purchase property, you have to have proof that you paid for it. Uh-huh. Now, in my case, now this is a question that that almost sounds too simple to be defrauded out of it. But when I bought my property back in 1970, I was a second owner from the original. Actually, the first owner out away from the original owner of it, and as such, he had the original patent, and the wording of the patent grants to the original patentee. It assigns to him his heirs, and that it grants to him his heirs and assigns this property, and the word is forever. Well, now that's a long time.
That's quite a stretch, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I being the person who bought, I've only bought half the property, but the I would be an assigned relative to that property, right?
Okay.
So that same patent number would carry over to me. Is that correct?
Well, it should, yeah.
Yeah, I would think so. Mm-hmm. So, how then could they lawfully or even legally take that property and put it on the tax rolls?
Who is they? You talking about the clerk at the courthouse?
No,
the county tax office. Look, I can help you. I know where you're going with this because I've been here before. What you need to do, and this will really help you, because I know all about the holder in due course, the warranty deed, the trust deed. There's three different kinds of deeds, and you want to accept a deed, and they always leave. You never get to accept a deed, especially if there's a mortgage, because the bank likes to leave that open, so that when it comes time to steal your property, they put their name in there. That's a negotiable instrument that's open. You need to accept it so that it's yours, so that you become the holder in due course, and that property's yours forever. I don't want to get into it, but what I'm going to tell you is go to YouTube, YouTube.com.
Okay.
And I'm going to give you, and put in there Rob Ryder, RobRyder, accept your deed. And you're going to come up with a bunch of videos, and he's very good, and he's very slow. He goes through each thing. I think he's great.
Do I need to write down accept your deed?
Yeah, that's what I would put. Rob Ryder, put that sentence. Rob Ryder, accept your deed. Once you get to the YouTube site, they have a search bar, and in that search bar on the top, type in Rob Ryder, accept your deed. And you're going to come up with a bunch of stuff. I got a whole page full of his videos. But the top two, accept the deed and be the owner, accept the deed and be the lawful owner, accept the deed and file and recorded what lies next. Good stuff, and I know where you're going, and this is going to answer all your questions, and it's going to straighten out what they're doing with deeds and how they're operating and how they're moving them, things that we've never thought of. Of course, the lawyers have all thought of them over there that do the real estate stuff, you know. They know it all.
Yeah, I've seemed to come to the conclusion that there must be some subterfuge from the real estate people themselves as well as the recorder's office.
Absolutely. And you know what? When I was doing title research and stuff, and I was in my local clerk's office looking at deeds and stuff, and back in the I don't know when it was. It was probably in the 38, 40. I noticed a lot of property changing hands between the same people that was bought and sold and bought and sold again within the same few weeks or months. And I think what they were doing was trying to clear the deed in order to get a clear title to accept that deed. And they sold it back and forth, sometimes between husband and wife. And I do believe it was that what they were doing was they were getting those names off the deed and making sure that they were the holder in due course. And the way that they did that was by changing it back and forth and making sure that they became the holder in due course. And that'll become clear when you watch his videos. It's been a while. Look, I'm going by memory from a couple of years ago, but believe me, you'll find that site very informative. I know where you're going, and you're going to like this.
Do you think that this site will give me, for example, and this is the last question I have, I think it's good to have for my purpose. After a while, you kind of forget what really it would be, say, if you were just buying the property, what would be the appropriate sequence of documents that you should have to end up to be the holder in due course?
He goes through it step by step, very methodical.
Okay.
I'm telling you, you're going to like it. He goes slowly, and he goes through each step. You go try it. Let me know what you think next time, okay?
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Good evening.
Yeah. Thank you. I have to find the site because I'm lost now. Here we go. I went on to YouTube to help Mount and couldn't get back. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to push you off there, Brett, but I just knew the subject matter there.
Oh, I didn't have much say. I'm just going to give some general principle that I thought applied, so that's fine.
Yeah. Next caller is Gary from Michigan.
Hello, Gerard and Mr. Hey. Winters.
Hi.
Do you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Well, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Another excellent program. We had a situation here in central Michigan with a group that I'm associated with. I guess we could call us We the People. We're really upset with a posting that was on, I believe, WorldNet Daily, and it listed all of the executive orders coming down from Obama compared with all the previous presidents, and it's scandalous, just in the numbers. I won't go into that right now, but I was compelled to answer that posting on the Obama presidential orders. And if I might, I would like to read my short one-paragraph response to that. And I said, sure. You might at first glance think that all of these executive orders indicate that a president that really does not have the best interest of we the people, and I've got that in quotations, at heart, and I think that would be exactly correct. But, and then there's a couple question marks, how can this happen in America, the land of the free and the home of the brave? Question mark. Well, to check on these executive orders that have not been played, the check on these executive orders that have not been played in Congress, it is their duty to review and to stop these orders if they do not agree. Can you hear the silence? It's deafening. And why is that happening? It is happening because we the people, once again in quotation marks, have not held Congress's feet to the fire like we are duty bound to do. We are the people that we've been waiting for, and we have let us down. In 2017, let us, we the people, change all of this. And I'd like to have a comment from Brent and Gerard, if you could, please.
Gerard, do you have something you want to say first? Oh, wait.
Well, I don't know what to say, to be honest with you. Oh, it is disgusting. Yeah. And what I will say is, all those executive orders that Obama is writing, there is no provision in the Constitution for him to be doing that. Now, he might be the chief executive up there, and he could give orders to those agencies that he's in control of, but a lot of what he's doing goes way beyond that, and there is no authority there. That's all. That's my take on that. And I don't think that – I think they're null and void. They just need to be nullified. I think when Donald Trump gets in, we're hoping that with the stroke of a pen, he'll write those out, which I believe he can do. But regardless, I think we've more got to worry about the damage that he's doing between now and when he leaves, with those decisions that can't be overturned after he leaves, like what he's doing on the international stage. He wants to do as much as he can before he leaves that can't be changed. Those executive orders are just, I'll be honest with you, I think they're just designed they're false flags to get us ticked off. That's my opinion anyway, but go ahead, Brett.
Well, I like to start at the beginning a little bit and make the observation that executive orders, properly used, are lawful every time the executive department gives an order to the chief of staff of the military establishment. That's lawful. That's his job. That's his duty. That's his jurisdiction to make sure and say yes or no, up or down, do this or don't do that. And every time he gives an order to the Justice Department or gives an order to the taxing authority, the Internal Revenue Service, those orders are to be followed. And, of course, they are to be within the law. Now, traditionally, the executive orders were for the executive to direct those under his authority as to how to enforce the law that Congress had passed. That was the original idea. Presidents through the centuries, from the very beginning, have chosen to enforce the laws they wanted to enforce and not enforce others. Some presidents have issued executive orders to the different departments of government to not enforce a particular law Congress has passed. And people say, well, is that lawful? Well, yes, under our Constitution it is. And as I learned when I took a test in the eighth grade and then one get out of high school, we had to take a test on the Constitution and pass the test. And we learned that our three branches of government are co-equal. Co-equal. No branch has a complete trumping power over the other. And it is the duty, by the way, of every president, just like the duty of every congressman and every judge, to make his own independent judgment, and the duty of every juror, by the way, every American, to make his own independent judgment as to what is constitutional and what is not. And therein lies our great strength. And so when the president says, Congress passed a law, and the president says, I'm not going to enforce that, I don't believe it's lawful, I don't believe it's constitutional. He has a duty. Some people say he has a right. Well, that right is a duty to do that. He must say yes or he must say no. He must exercise his duty, his discretion, his jurisdiction. But when presidents get to the place that they just want to do what they want to do and they don't give two hoots and a holler about the Constitution, that's different. That's very much different. And that's what we have going now and have had it for several presidencies. Andrew Jackson one time said, the Supreme Court has made this decision. Now let's see if they can enforce it. And his point was, I'm going to enforce my decision, and it's going to be different than the Supreme Court's. He did that, and he did it, and he wrote a long opinion about it. He did it on the basis of the Constitution. And he said, when I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, I did not take an oath to support and defend it as some other man understands it. I took an oath to support and defend it as I understand it. Well, of course, he's right. How is it possible to take an oath to swear to do what somebody else tells you to do and not think about it? That's not even possible. And when you take the oath, or I take the oath, or when a juror takes the oath, by the way, that's the meaning of the word juror, is oath taker. When he takes an oath to support the law and do what the law says and do right, just do right, he's bound to exercise it. It is his duty. His duty, his jurisdiction, his right, his authority to exercise independent judgment. And he better do it. Well, this has worked real good for us, these independent judgment ideas of our presidents. It worked good for us as long as presidents had a sincere, bona fide devotion to the Constitution of the United States. I do not see that now. As a matter of fact, I see clearly that this man, his oath to him, this man, I don't know what he is, but the oath that he apparently took, he perjured himself. What does that mean? That means that the oath he took was a lie. He took the oath saying he would do something with an exact opposite goal in mind, said to destroy the Constitution of the United States. I don't think there's any question. No question. That's what he's out to do. He is here to destroy the United States. That's why he was put into office by the minions of the useful idiots of the evil empire. So it's different now. And his executive orders made to his bureaucracies are, from what I've seen, many of them lawless, utterly lawless, with no thought of our Constitution of the United States, no opinion explaining why he did what he did, as Andrew Jackson, for example, did. And it is part of our common law tradition that when magistrates, presidents, judges, whoever they may be, legislators, when they make decisions that they reveal and tell to people, they write on paper their reasons behind their decisions. And if they dissent to tell why they dissent, why they're not going to enforce this law. I remember when Ronald Reagan decided to, the union said, of course, what he did, he busted the unions, but he decided to fire air traffic controlmen from their positions if they went on strike. And when he did, then he wrote out a long opinion as why the law required him to do that. And then he got on television and he told the American people, in sum, he made a brief of his opinion, told them why he did what he did. That was the habit, the custom. That's part of our common law tradition. And even if he's wrong, at least he tells us why, and we can evaluate it, think about it ourselves when a president did that. I don't see that happening here. I just see things done in secret. He just recently signed a bill in secret on Christmas Eve to destroy freedom of the press as much as he possibly could in America, freedom of speech along with it. So that's my view of executive orders. They're utterly necessary. The executive is bound to make orders. That's his job. That's his duty. That's his jurisdiction. He must say yes, he must say no, and he must say why in any given instance. But to just sign executive orders telling the people below him to disregard the law, that's to disregard the Constitution, is quite something different. That's all I had, Jordan.
Thank you for that, Brent and Gerard. And I sure do agree with that, because I think the whole foundation of his presidency is false, and that's been substantiated for some time now by Sheriff Arapaios out of Arizona's finding on his posse's finding on the document that he submitted that is absolutely fraud. So if that's a fraud, does not that make his whole presidency a fraud?
It does, but keep in mind this also, that, again, in the common law tradition, and this comes from our ancient past, and we have to repair it, our ancient past, to deal with some of these things, and Blackstone makes much about this in his commentaries also, and before that, Mint had. The king was the executive power in England and in other the Nordic countries, and the ones under the Volkreich, and there's that word again, right, the Volk, the people, right, duty, the duty of the people. Under that idea, when a king was in office unlawfully, by coup or whatever, unlawfully for whatever reason, they said that he was a de facto king. He wasn't a de jure king. He wasn't a king in law, having followed the law. He was a king. In fact, though, he was there, and he's calling the shots. And they used to say this. They said when the unlawful executive is in power, as I believe also with this fellow, he clearly is not a natural-born citizen. That means, contrary to what we hear in the press, that means that to be natural born, both of your parents must be citizens of the United States at the time of your birth. both of your parents must be citizens of the United States at the time of your birth. That was not true of Obama, whatever his name is. I don't even know if that's his name. That's his name. But that's not true of the fellow sitting in the White House now, and that was not true of Ted Cruz, and that was not true of Rubio. It's amazing. 99.999% of all Americans are natural-born citizens, and we can't find any to run for president. Four people run for president. Now, what does that tell you about what's going on? That tells me there's some serious conspiracy going on, and has been for a long time. There are powers behind powers manipulating things, something fierce to destroy the country. But back to the question, when the de facto executive is in power, men are bound to obey him, in his lawful acts until the problem is remedied. That's been the ancient common law. And the reason, of course, they did that was so that some semblance of order could be maintained until the problem was corrected. Now, amazingly, in America, unlike old England and the old Nordic countries, we don't have we have a mandatory change of executive every 4 years. We should be very thankful for that. Because when the wrong man gets in, and clearly Obama, if that's his name, is not qualified under our law, under our Constitution, to be president, because he is not a natural-born citizen. Both his parents were not citizens at the time of his birth. Second, he was not born on American soil, its territories, or its property. Its property, such as John McCain. John McCain was born on property controlled by the United States, the Panama Canal Zone. I don't know exactly where, probably a hospital or something down there. But so he had that, at least. But there have been others that haven't had it. For example, Romney, is that his name? The fellow that ran against Obama last time, the fellow from Massachusetts, his father ran for president. And his father bowed out of the race because his father was from, they're from Mormon family. And his father was born in a Mormon settlement in Mexico. He wanted to run for president, and he finally was forced out. He quit. He said, I can't do this. Well, we need that kind of public opinion put against these fellows. We need to be able to examine their pedigrees. My goodness, men, the most powerful position in the world, a real monopoly of force and violence like the world has never known. That's what the president has. And he's not going to make it abundantly clear that he's a natural-born citizen. That's what our Constitution requires. And the reason our Constitution requires it, because our common law requires it. And the reason our common law requires it, because the Bible requires it. It's in Deuteronomy, chapter 18, 17. You can read it all there. If you're going to have a ruler among you, government of the people, by the people, and for the people, as the Gettysburg Address puts it, you got to have a man that, and it says it just this way, that is of the people, by the people. That means from. Of means from, the preposition. Of, from, and by, and for the benefit of the people. That's what the words, the Hebrew words, mean in Deuteronomy. So this is an ancient idea, and it's necessary to hold the country together. There is no other office in America that requires a man to be a natural-born citizen except the office of the President of the United States, and for good reason. I have plenty of friends whose children are not qualified to be president and never will be. Why? They're not natural-born. Why? Because both of their parents were not citizens of the United States at the time of their birth. Is that okay? Well, you know, you don't have to be president to be successful in America. I mean, who wants the job? But the point I'm making is it is a special office and a special responsibility, a special duty, a special right is given to presidents. And because of that, we have set a standard very, very high. And the only persons that were natural-born citizens of the United States were those born in the British colonies before we became a country, namely George Washington, right up through Andrew Jackson. I think the president after Jackson was the last non-natural-born citizen, and our Constitution made provision for that to make it clear. And then after that, you better be natural-born.
Well,
that's all I have.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you, Brent. Because
you bet.
That goes right back to Obama's beginning. He should have been stopped before he ever got there if Congress was doing their duty.
That's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
they dropped the ball, but then there, that's a whole other question, and I won't go into that tonight. But that's what I'm saying. This, we the people have got to hold Congress. We've got to hold everybody that we like. We just can't go down and vote twice a year and think that everything's going to be cool and be taken care of. We have got to stay on the line and keep these people's feet to the fire. And if we don't learn that we have to do that, then we're not going to, nothing's going to change. And I guess one thing that I would have added to this little comment that I added to the Facebook thing is that one of the big factors in this whole problem that we're facing is the media. We have been programmed right from, I can go back to birth, I guess, through school and whatever, to think that that's what we have to do. We go down, vote twice a year, and everything's cool, and everything's taken care of, and right through school. But high school, whatever, college, advanced education, that's not so. We have to pay attention to what's going on, and it is our duty to do that. And I guess at the beginning of this year, in 2017, that's the message that that I've seen, and I'm going to pass it on to all my friends and my circle and whatever, and I hope that everybody listening tonight could do the same thing. And I sure do appreciate Brent and Gerard, all that you're doing. It's been a great program. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you.
Okay. Our next caller is a wireless caller. Looks like 1073 is the last four. What's your name and your state? You've been unmuted.
This is Rod from Oregon.
Hey, Rod. How's it going?
Hey, I'm still breathing. this not may be biblical, but it goes that he bless those who speak little because their phone bill will be less. Anyway, I wanted to thank you guys. This was the first time I've ever been on this call, and I was invited by another friend who's probably listening right now, and there's something I'll tell you here, but the main thing I wanted to say after listening to you guys almost for the last hour possibly, man, I want to thank you for your tenacity, man, your knowledge and your wisdom, and especially your patience. It's greatly appreciated, and also the help you've been probably for a lot of people, but patience is really important, and I've appreciated it because there's been some of the things I've heard, sometimes, like with me, I'd want to just scream or yell or say, okay, you know, and run at that time. But anyway, thank you guys. You should be commended. But anyway, I got on this call basically because I guess somebody had inquired earlier about finding some case law concerning the jurisdiction and authority that these a-holes, which I call them, administrative hearing officers, and that's, we abbreviate that with the acronym of A-hole, you know, and what jurisdiction they have. So I have a case law here that I came across. I don't know if it'll help, but it was actually from the North Carolina Supreme Court back in 1779 or something of that nature. I don't know if it will help, but I can, you know, tell you what that is. It's you probably may have seen it, Cruden versus Neal in North Carolina. This is back in 1796.
Oh yeah, we've quoted that one in a few of our cases, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I was under the impression that somebody had you know, was looking for something, so I thought I'd just bring that to your attention. Maybe I wasn't on the call at that time, so maybe that's what you already told him, but I thought, you know, maybe...
No, I didn't. Matter of fact, why don't you kind of read it real quick? I mean, I know that we've used Cruden versus Neal, but go ahead.
Well, I can read it real quick. It's not real long.
Yeah.
Okay, it says, when a change of government takes place from a monarchical to a republican government, the old form is dissolved. those who lived under it and did not choose to become members of the new had a right to refuse their allegiance to it and to retire elsewhere. By being a part of the society subject to the old government, they had not entered into any engagement to become subject to any new form the majority might think proper to adopt. That the majority shall prevail is a rule posterior to the formation of government and results from it. It is not a rule binding upon mankind in their natural state. There, every man is independent of all laws except those prescribed by nature. He is not bound by any institutions formed by his fellow men without his consent. And I guess this was emphasis added on this, you know, Neil or Crude versus Neil. And, you know, one other thing I'll say real quick. I don't know if you're aware. I don't know. Are you guys in Oregon, or are you somewhere else in the on the planet here?
No, we're all in different places all throughout. I'm in New York, and you know,
oh, okay.
this is a nationwide show, so
oh, okay.
I have no idea where anybody is.
Okay, well, I'm just using our state for reference here in Oregon, and this was a law that was put on the books, a statute, if you will, or whatever, back in 1923. And this was by design, of course, but I'm paraphrasing somewhat, but it was ORS, if anybody ever wanted to look this up, it's ORS 336, it's 057 and 067. And what it basically states, that commencing in all institutions of public education, commencing from the eighth grade, shall have full curriculum of constitutional studies, country and state, even up through four levels of college. And to this very day, that has not been implemented, has not been, you know, put in any institution of education that I'm aware of, let alone even mentioned. And the reason why this came to my attention is because there was another individual that of some years ago, before we got distracted on a bunch of other insanity and stuff, we were sitting down to figure a way to even draw up a class action, you know, lawsuit and even criminal charges against the Board of Education here in this state because of them failing to actually implement this law. It's their law. They put on the books. Why isn't it happening type of thing? So I don't know how far that would go or where, how far you would get with it, but it just kind of validated the fact that this just wasn't haphazardly thrown off to the side or we'll forget it. It's something that's probably been buried, you know, for many years for obviously nefarious reasons, as we know where we're at. But anyway, that's my story. I'm sticking to it.
We got a guy over here in New York. Look at, we have a law in the books in New York State that says that they're supposed to be teaching the Constitution and American history up through 12th grade. And let me tell you something. It isn't happening. And that was the discussion of bringing a case against the state for not enforcing that law. I mean, they thought it. I think it's in the New York State Constitution. Don't hold me to that, but I'm pretty sure that it's in the Constitution because it's in all the it's statewide, so it must be the New York State Constitution. It couldn't be the federal Constitution; it has to be the state, right? So we have a law just like that that's not being enforced. I know that for a fact. And that's maybe that's a good thing for people to get onto. The only trouble is I don't trust a school to teach the Constitution. I don't know what
they're
all kinds of baloney, you know?
we've been
the second situation worse than the first, right?
Yeah, we've all been dumbed down enough.
Well, they have a definite plan behind their dumbing down. So
absolutely.
I'd rather be dumbed than brainwashed, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, well, who knows? Half the time you sit there and you think, how can you believe anything you hear anymore half the time or really see it? But, hey, guys, anyway, again, I appreciate your time. I'll probably get back on another call again. I'm sure you got other people waiting to talk, so I'm going to let you guys move on and make it happen.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, buddy.
I think we got time for maybe one more. We're getting close. it looks like 1702 is the last four of the phone. Let me see. I'm going to unmute you now.
Hey. What's up? How are you?
I guess you can hear me now.
Yeah, that's me, Donaldson, again, Jeremiah, here in Northern California. I was actually going to ask about the family law and actually make a comment about that. I heard some previous caller talking about the family law, and I thought I wanted to mention that, you know, it's come to my attention through studies, right, that there is some noise in the background, by the way. So it's come to my attention through some studies that basically the family law issue is that the state is there, is present, but they don't make decisions. They're not supposed to be making decisions regarding the rights, okay? Because they don't have an actual direct interest in the actual, you know, the property at issue. I suppose I could use those words. But they're there as a party of the contract just by observations, you know, and when you, like, do the whole marriage contract thing, that basically, you know, is what allows the state to kind of act as a third party, kind of the intervener, mediator kind of position. But they definitely are not the ones in control of the situation with that. So I would definitely look into, as far as remedy is concerned for family law, the go do a keyword search at your law library and find some case law or actually some secondary sources through like LexisNexis or Westlaw and read some articles about your particular issue, and that's actually going to help you out quite a bit. You know, you'll find that a lot of times because judges have to make determinations that will affect a future decision. It's called a rule. They'll make a rule. They have to be very careful about the rights that they are going to be interfering with when they do make their decisions. So a lot of these judges, I do believe, are aware of this kind of stuff. So I wouldn't be too hyped up on all the internet and hoopla, but definitely get into that law library if you can and do a keyword search on their database, and you can pull up some secondary sources, read some articles, and that's really going to give the better perspective on the family law. What do you have to say about that there, Brent? Because, you know, certainly the state should not have as much influence as it has in, or, you know, presumes to have in the life of the offspring, you know, the offspring of the parents that choose to contract. Go ahead.
Well, I would take issue with the word contract. Again, contrary to popular opinion, even in the legal community, marriage has never been a contract, as we understand a contract, common law. Marriage, we call the marriage ceremony, if somebody goes through one, we call it marriage vows. Vows. Vows are not promises made reciprocally among men, one to another, bride to groom. Vows are promises made direct to God. The groom makes a promise to God, or a set of promises, and the bride makes a set of promises. And in a contract, if the other side, if you exchange promises between yourself and the other side doesn't keep their promise, that's called breach, and you have the option of disregarding the contract entirely. Well, that's not true of marriage, because your promise is not to each other. It's to God. It's a vow. And you make them before God, to God, before witnesses, if there's a ceremony. I understand not everybody's had a ceremony. But even if you forego a ceremony and you've consummated marriage in the eyes of God, the courts are going to bend over backwards to find a marriage if push comes to shove and they need to find out. And the same standards apply, even though you didn't go through the ceremony. When by the act of consummation of the marriage, you've made a vow, a promise by your actions to God, and it's not dependent upon the behavior of the other party. And people may say to me, well, does that mean you can never get divorced? No, that does not mean that. The law of God says otherwise, and we can discuss that. But as a general, fundamental rule, marriage is not a contract. It's a set of vows that each person makes to God, not to each other. That's the power behind marriage. So it's special in that it certainly is a relationship. But as the Bible says, marriage is what God does, not what man does. It's the marriage vows are recognition of what God has put together. Therefore, let no man tear it asunder, as the old vows written by a fellow named Cranmer during the English Reformation said. He was he was burned at the stake for his beliefs. What a man, Cranmer. He was something else. I don't want to go into that. But it's important to examine those traditional vows and really, again, make every word tell. Contemplate what he said there. Those words spun off. Those were words pinned in the heat of the hottest of conflict in England and raging all across Europe. And Cranmer was at the heart of that by a quirk of circumstances. He didn't necessarily choose it. But so to start with, marriage is a set of vows to God, responsibilities, duties, rights. Rights are your stewardship responsibilities toward your children, if you have children. And it is true, as you had said, the courts have taken too much upon themselves in enforcement of the executive branch, namely Department of Family and Human Services. That's a travesty, but a destruction. And now, of course, it's come so bad and ugly, we know that pedophilia is part of our government, and that to take a child away from the family, the federal government will give $5,000 to DCFS in your respective states, whatever you call it there, if that department can get a child away from the family. The feds give them $5,000, thanks to Bill Clinton. Well, now we're trafficking children for money, to build up for money, and we know now from what we learned from WikiLeaks that these children are being trafficked in pedophilia rings. And on and on and on the madness goes. Madness. We got to talk about it. We can't do it as the Roman Church and just sweep it under the rug and say this doesn't exist and transfer the priest around different places. That's not the way to handle it. And you see what that's come to over the last 10 centuries, and it's been rife in that particular institution since the very beginning. Well, now it's in that's government. That's the government of the city law. Now we've got it worldwide in our own government. When you're talking about family law now and the encroachment, you're talking about some ugly, ugly stuff in our own country. And clearly, God has given the primary responsibility to parents. Now, if parents fall down on that, there are laws in place that give remedies to that particular problem, but it's gotten so bad with government control that you can't, even if you're paying child support, it's controlled by a place up in Iowa, I believe Des Moines gets all those big contracts that take money from fathers or mothers and give it to the other spouse. There is no remedy. If you lose your job, you still owe the money, you don't pay it, they throw you in jail, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's no longer an individual matter. Why is this happening? It's happening because divorce is rampant, really rampant. In my own lifetime, we've seen it go from next to nothing to over half. It doesn't make a difference what color your skin is, and it used to be just confined to the minority. It's not true anymore. And the culture is falling clear apart. Why? Because we aren't taught. We don't understand. We don't get it. What is marriage? Fundamentally, it's not a And I don't fault anybody for saying it's a contract. The legal community is saying that. So you can't expect other people not to know. It's not a contract, never been a contract, never been understood that way. And for a couple thousand years here anyway, maybe longer. I don't know all the history, but I know that because marriages are falling apart, children are left loose. And because children are left loose ends, then powerful parties step in and take advantage of the situation. That's what's happened. There's a remedy. The remedy is do the best you can in the midst of the madness. And if you don't depend upon God to protect you and your children and your family, no matter what the circumstance is, there is no protection. And the only way to protect, the only way for God to protect them is to get out of his way and let him do it. How do you do that? You just simply do what he tells you to do. And he's given us plenty of marching orders. We haven't even begun. Most of them scratched the surface. You got a problem over here with your children. You got a problem with your wife. You got a problem with your husband. You got marriage problems. God says, oh, you got a problem over there. Most people want to go fix it. That's not what God says to do. Don't go fix your problem. Just do what I tell you to do. Follow due process. That's the only chance you have for order in your life. And order is the only way you're going to have freedom, peace of mind and freedom. And children are a big part of that. That was the original question. We must do all we can to protect children. How do we do that? Again, we follow the law of God. We follow it at every point we can. We have to learn it first. And it comes down to what is marriage. We must understand that as a matter of law before we can move forward with trying to remedy the problems in families, children, and marriage. And marriage exists primarily for one reason, and that is to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. By the way, that's the stated doctrine for the reason of marriage in many of our states. And the primary reason, that's why when there are children involved in a legal problem, equity in the family court, BIC is the rule, best interest of the child. Parents don't matter anymore because children are everything. The productivity, children are productivity. They are the yield of marriage. That's what makes God happy. That's what he wants. And even if that doesn't happen, all of us must engage in every way we can to put out the truth about what marriage is, and that's protection of children. That's the only protection they're going to have that has real power is family. The best health, education, and welfare institution that has ever been devised is the family, man, woman, together, working together for the good of children. Appreciate your question.
Thank you, Brent. Hey, we're about out of time, but I just want to make a comment here. You know, I know in my state, in New York State, that the state education department had changed the education law, that, and it reads that it used to read for many, many years that the parent is the primary educator of the child. And they turned that around and they said the state is the primary educator of a child. I mean, how scary is that? But
yeah.
I think it's very prevalent in many states because I heard that Donald Trump he's from New York also. Maybe this why he knows that. He said that he was going to change it back to the parent being the primary educator of the child. So I have to assume it's more than just in New York State.
And yeah.
I hope that happens. I don't know how he can do that as president, but, you know, he's got the bully pulpit, and
yeah.
I hope he uses it because it's very hard for homeschooled people when if it says the state is the primary educator and you try to homeschool your kids, let me tell you what, you're setting yourself up for a lot of baloney with them, you know? So that's an important thing to watch out for now, and hopefully we can get that would be a big step in getting us back our rights as far as us educating our children, you know, the way that we want to in the curriculums that we like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we're go ahead, Brent.
I was going to say that this for state to this contrary to three U.S. Supreme Court cases, one from 1920s and one from 1960s. First versus Society of Sisters, Mayer versus Nebraska, those were the 1920s cases, and then Yoder versus Wisconsin. It was an Amish case about an Amishman that wanted to take did not want to send his child to high school. Eighth grade was enough. And the Supreme Court upheld that case. All three of those are the pronouncements of our Supreme Court according to our constitutional rights, our duties toward our children, and which is education. That's the primary duty, and the court said that. So look, contrary,
you're kind of breaking up there again, Brent. I'm having trouble.
Oh,
hearing.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
You know, if you got three Supreme Court rulings and New York is saying that it's the state, I wonder if it isn't just the education department's rule or statute or policy or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's prevalent. You know, how can they go against something that's been three Supreme Court rulings? Yet I know for a fact that the New York State Department of Education, that's what their stupid I don't know what it is, their rules, their mission statement, whatever, it states in there that the state is the primary educator, which is very Orwellian to me.
No, me too. It doesn't surprise me, but at the same time, it's still shocking. There's obviously two forces afoot here, and we see the one represented in those Supreme Court rulings and recognizing fundamental rights of parents given by God, direct to the person, duties, recognizing those, and recognizing that parents have them and they can't be redelegated to anybody else. And then the evil empire coming along, probably saying to the state of New York, the Federal Department of Education, we're going to give you any money unless you adopt this policy. That's evil.
Exactly.
That's dirt. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Brent. We're kind of over time by 7 minutes, so we're going to end it. Thank you, everybody, for coming out. Happy New Year, and hopefully we have a happy and blessed New Year and a much better country than we did last year. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, bye, Lord.
Yeah. Bye, bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Jan.